because Megyn Kelly is actually, rather than being a journalist, what she is an advocate for the right wing. That's why she draws the big-time Radio Rwanda bucks. It's a long clip. But even if we don't run all of it, you'll get the sense of it.
In the end, I just can't do it. Can't live out my fantasy. So now I'm flipping burgers. My boss, well, he's just...
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell... I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
And welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Abe Amoros, legislative director for the Laborers International Union, LIUNA, going to be here talking about the big speech tomorrow, the budget. Where's Tom Corbett going to go? What to expect? What kind of cuts? And what kind of pain? And I'm expecting lots and lots of it. Also, Peter Buckland, he's a PhD candidate at the Educational Theory and Policy Unit there at Penn State College of Education. He's also the co-founder of Environment Ecology Education in the College of Education, so that'll be interesting. He's riding his bike 110 miles from his home in Pine Grove Mills here to the Capitol to raise awareness to the Marcellus Shale. So figure out why he's doing it and go from there. But tomorrow morning is the day of reckoning. It is the day of reckoning. It is upon us now. All these years of financial irresponsibility, Grandfather Tom will come to the podium and he will set us all straight. He and he alone can bring us back to sanity. At least that's the way it's going to be rolled out to us, that, you know, we've been just been gluttonous, so, you know, all that want of health care and education and higher education and hospitals and taking care of those people with disabilities and all that greed, gluttony. What we're going to have now is sanity, good, solid, conservative rule, which I understand is going to come with major pain. And, of course, for all you folks who complain about your property taxes being too high, higher property taxes. So get ready for it, because this is a big ball of it. I can't say the SH part, but this is it. It is rolling downhill, and it is coming very quickly. And as you know, it always rolls downhill and stops at the bottom, where you and I, the taxpayers, are. So get ready for it. Because it is coming. And you know what I've been amazed about is how quiet the Corbett people have been, how close to the vest they have been. There have been no leaks. There haven't even been any hints of leaks. So I think that's a testament to how secretive this guy is compared to the doofus you've got in Wisconsin, who just can't seem to keep his mouth shut. The same thing with Christie in New Jersey. You got a lot of these right-wingers who they want the spotlight. They want to be recognized as the man. They're the one in charge. They're the one taking command. And, you know, this guy we got here, I think is more deadly than the Walkers and the Christies, because he's going to appear to be very rational. He's going to be very, very grandfatherly. And who could not love their grandfather? Sometimes he's stern, but he knows best. And while you've got the turd's eyes of the world and the crazy Metcalfs and all of the crazy out there right wingers who want to take the party way off into the extreme, understand, he's not too far behind them. But as long as they're out there, you can always point to them and say, they're too extreme. But our guy, Tom, our guy, the corporate man, he's moderate. He's going to put us back on the path. And that's what this is really, it's been interesting to watch. And it's going to be even more interesting to watch in the coming days how the public reacts to the deep, drastic, draconian cuts that are coming. These aren't scalpel cuts, I don't believe. These are going to be chainsaw, hatchet, Texas chainsaw massacre type budget cuts. School districts, understand, you're going to see $1 billion less money. He's already kind of said that. Not to mention, you're going to see probably another billion less when they kick up this voucher program. When we start privatizing education, when we start stealing education from children to pay the big profiteers. Understand, you're going to get less money. So in turn, what that means is you and I, the taxpayer, we're going to get saddled with higher local costs, higher property taxes, higher local services, or basically just the elimination of those. And for me, what I fear, you know, I think back to when I was in school, when I was, ninth, 10th grade, I was on the edge. I was kind of on a bubble there where I didn't see the purpose. My mother had passed away when I was in eighth grade. My things weren't going well at home. Had it not been for football and the football coach who gave me some direction for a short period of time that put me on the right track, who knows where I would have been. Now, you look at what's going to happen in the coming years to education in this state and really across the country. Those type of programs are going to be gone. They're eliminating extracurricular activities at an alarming rate. I was talking to somebody the other day who said they had to pay $200 to play football. What happened to team spirit? What happened to all of that, Friday night football, all that stuff? Well, we're doing away with it. Why? So the profiteers can have more money. And understand, we're going to get less services. We're going to get less of all the things that we've paid for. State workers, sorry, you guys are going to take a major whack in this. And it doesn't have to be that way. This is the culmination of years of fiscal irresponsibility by your elected leaders. Not so much in their spending. Yes, occasionally there were times where spending got a little out of hand. But the spending that I'm talking about, the irresponsibility that I'm talking about, is the fact that they never raise taxes on the people who have the money. They always settled for cuts or raises in fees. So it didn't look like they were raising taxes. And at the end of the day, that hits you and me. So when his budget comes out tomorrow, when he lays all this out and he starts saying, we're going to have to start tightening our belts because, the money that we're spending on higher education, well, sorry, we're going to have to cut some of that back. So mom and dad, you're going to have to kick in a little bit more for tuition. And sorry, junior, that means more student loans if you can get them. And we'll have a governor standing there saying, sorry, your times are tough, in that very grandfatherly tone. Because, he's got that appearance. Like Kris Kringle. And he's going to be the guy who's going to make everything all right. And if you're someone with disabilities in this state, you're in for a real treat. Because as I'm hearing, and again, this is stuff that across the board cuts and privatization. when we start talking about privatizing these core functions, you know, like taking care of children and taking care of people with disabilities and education and parks and recreation, museums, all of these things that historically we the people, as part of our commons, have said we want our government to take care of. Libraries. I mean, I can see it down the road. At some point, this governor saying, you know what, we should privatize the libraries. And it's all about the corporate way. It's all about being business friendly. And on the federal level, all we see on the federal level is pain. Pain, pain, pain. A $61 billion cut Republicans want to make. Most economists have said it's going to cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of 700,000 jobs. And remember, these folks ran on the we're going to create jobs platform. Yet by cutting that kind of spending, you're costing jobs. Because I guess it just doesn't dawn on them that when government spends money for things that it needs, for services that we demand, that somehow that creates jobs. I don't think they've figured that quite out yet. And when they want to talk about zeroing out the funding for national public radio and for public television, that's how a lot of us get our news. They want to privatize that. They want to corporatize it. They want it to be just like fake news over at Fox or CNN, who, you know, while we were in Wisconsin, one of the greatest quotes I saw is, thank you, CNN, for telling me what's on Twitter. Because there were no reporters on the ground. They want to take money away from health centers. They want to cut food programs. They want to cut health care programs. They want to steal from women and children. And this isn't just rhetoric. This is reality. They want to cut food programs. They want to cut WIC. They want to cut aid. And they want to cut medical care for women who are pregnant. Yet they tell us that they're the Family Values Party. Yet they tell us that they care about children. That they're anti-abortion because they believe in life. When all they really are is pro-birth. And even if they're just pro-birth, don't you think taking care of that fetus until it comes out is a good thing to do? Some of the other things they wanted to work on doing, they want to cut pre-K. No more Head Start, sorry. They claim that that doesn't work. They want to cut teachers, and they want to cut firemen, and they want to do all of these very draconian things that over time we have decided that we want. And again, it comes back down to this, what is it that we want our government to do? And I agree with Turdzai. I absolutely agree. We need to have the conversation of what are core government functions? What do I want my government doing? What services should they be providing? And who should be doing it? And I go back to that story that I told last, when we came back from Wisconsin, of the guy who was behind the counter where I got my oil changed. Angry about the state worker who's going to retire from his job to take the exact same job in the private sector, paying twice as much. And time and time again, when you see that, that's generally what happens. We privatize these functions, and somehow it always ends up costing us more. And I've been doing this nearly 6 years now, and I've been asking people, call me. If you've got an example where privatization has saved us some money, I want to know about it. Because I want to check it out. If you can show me we're privatizing anything that our government used to do, saves us money, is more efficient, and this is the key part of this, provides the service that we demand and need, please, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, because I've yet to find it, and no one's yet to call. And that tells me it doesn't exist. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Michigan is joining Wisconsin, Indiana, and Ohio in vigorous resistance to a national assault on working families. Doug Cunningham files this report.
United Auto Workers President Bob King said workers everywhere must rise up against a coordinated national attack on collective bargaining rights for workers. The UAW and allies will rally at Lansing March 14th to protest Michigan Republican Governor Snyder taking away collective bargaining rights for 70,000 home health care workers. The UAW is also protesting a slash-and-burn budget in Michigan that takes from working families and gives to the rich and corporations.
There is an agenda. There's a strategy being done across America by the Republican Party to destroy the middle class in America. And if we don't stand up and fight this, whether it's in Michigan or Wisconsin or Ohio or any other state in the union, we're not going to have a middle class. And we're not going to have workers having the democratic right, the freedom of association, freedom of speech. And that's what being a union is a part of. We believe very strongly that budgets are moral documents. Don't say you care about families and then pass budgets that destroy families.
Last week, the Ohio Senate passed Bill SB5, which attacks the right of workers to collectively bargain. Unlike a similar bill proposed in the state of Wisconsin, the Ohio legislation additionally removes the right of firefighters and law enforcement to collectively bargain. The state's assembly is expected to take up the bill this week. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan took to the floor of the House of Representatives last week and said the legislation proposed in his home state is unfair and undermines American values.
Firefighters who go in the burning buildings when we're all running out of them, police officers who we call up when we're in trouble, or teachers that we ask in many instances to spend more time with our kids than we do, somehow push the blame of the major financial meltdown that happened because of Wall Street recklessness, blame the teachers for that?
Ryan added that budgeting priorities in Ohio seem to be out of line.
We have the top person who worked for the current administration get a $40,000 pay increase from what the last governor was paying, and the secretaries and the people in the mailroom get a cut, and the firefighters and the police and the teachers get a cut. While all this is going on in Ohio, they want to cut the estate tax for the wealthiest people who live in the state of Ohio and ask the teacher to make the sacrifice.
This newscast was made possible in part by underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. It's Manufacturing Monday.
Hello.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. John McCain was on ABC's This Week with Christiane Amanpour, talking about the decline of American manufacturing. And if you remember, ABC did a nice bit, and I really thought it was well done, and it really struck a note with me. And I think a lot of other folks, to highlight the loss of manufacturing, in this country, they took this home, this marketing executive, if I remember he was, and, told the family, hey, let's go around your house and see what's made in the U.S. And, cause, these people thought, hey, we buy stuff that's made in the U.S. Absolutely, sure. We all think that, right? So this couple and their children decided, okay, fine, we'll leave the house and let them, the people from ABC, take everything out of the house that was not made in the U.S. And not surprising, the only thing that was left in the house when they were done was some cheap vase. And, it was for a visual, it's quite shocking. But the reality is, and one of the facts that they used, in 1960, they said foreign goods made up just 8% of American purchases. 8%. You ask yourself, why was the middle class so large? Why did people have disposable income in the 60s? 8% of what Americans purchased was made outside the country. Today, they say nearly 60% of everything we buy is made overseas. And I got to be honest, I would argue that it's got to be, when you're talking consumer goods, it's got to be higher than that. our trade policies are really putting us at a disadvantage. But anyway, McCain was on with this Christiane Amanpour, and he had some really interesting, really to prove that he has no clue what he's talking about. Listen to this.
Well, I think it's obviously a recognition of the reality and the trends that cheaper, lower cost labor products will usually prevail over products made in a higher wage and income countries. But
lower wage countries will prevail over higher wage countries, which is why you have trade policies that take that into account, which we don't. Kind of interesting. So then he goes on and says, well, there are things made in the U.S. Of course there are.
I would also point out that if you'd emptied that house there, if you'd left a computer there or an iPad or an iPhone, those are built in the United States of America.
No, they are not. Stop that. It just makes you sound stupid. I mean, even I know that. To say that there has not been, and Mark, this is fact, there has not been one cell phone made in this country. It was developed here. It was developed in Israel, but it was also developed here in the U.S. They don't produce them here. They produce them, most of them, in Sweden, which actually has a higher standard of living than we do and a better wage structure and national health care. Well, that kind of screws that all up, doesn't it? But the reality is none of that stuff's made here, even though, iPad, yes. You know, the iCran was made here, too. Because here's the thing. He's trying to sound like he's hip. Yeah, I got an iPad. Probably can't even turn it on. But here's the kicker. And this is one of those things that make me, again, this got to stick to the frames, got to stick to the talking points.
The president said continuously, and I agree with him, innovation is the key to us being able to restore our economy. And that's got to be exports.
It's got to be exports. But if we don't build anything, what are we exporting? If this is true.
Well, I think it's obviously a recognition of the reality and the trends that cheaper, lower cost labor products will usually prevail over products made in a higher wage and income of countries. But
so if that's true, if products made in cheaper wage countries always prevail over those made in higher wage countries, how can we compete with China? How can we compete with India? How can we compete with any of those? So he goes on to talk about free trade because, of course, he's a Republican, got to buy into the whole free trade mantra, got to have it.
To have free trade agreements. I'm glad the president's supporting South Korea free trade agreement. We've basically abandoned Colombia and Panama. All these other countries are concluding free trade agreements amongst themselves while we are being left behind. And that's very harmful.
So if we go back to the first thing he said, low-wage countries with lower wages usually prevail over high-wage countries. I would consider South Korea, I would consider Panama and Colombia lower-wage countries than we are. So given his first premise, if you buy into what he said, which is that lower-wage countries usually prevail over higher-wage countries, why would you want to pursue more free trade agreements that pit you against lower-wage countries when you know they're going to prevail? Now, this is a guy who could have been president. Can someone explain that to me? Because I'm not getting it. So then he goes on, you got to have the cherry on top. Everyone loves their sundae with a little whipped cream and a little cherry on top. Here it is.
Statistic. 2 years ago, 40% of the imports of agricultural goods in Colombia were from the United States of America. They concluded free trade agreements. Now 20% is there. So we have the ability to outcompete any other country in the world and out-innovate.
Oh, yeah, we can compete and out-innovate. What I find ironic is he chose agriculture. He chose farming where we import Mexican labor. Are you freaking kidding me? I mean, stop and really, really think about what this guy just laid out. He could have been president. And I would argue that the guy who's sitting in the White House probably thinks the same way he does. And every other one of those guys sitting in the halls of power think that way. Paul Krugman had an interesting piece today, Degrees and Dollars. And He talks about what the president said last week, declaring that, quote, if we want more good news on the jobs front, then we've got to make more investments in education. And I find it interesting that the more educated a society we become, the less wealth that the middle class seems to have. And he goes through and he's talking about legal research, and he's talking about medical research, and how computers are taking away those high-educated jobs, and basically hollowing out the high-educated workers. He's saying, you know, you've got the very, very high-end, the very, very technical people, and the very, very low-wage people, and they're doing okay. It's everybody else in the middle that's being lost in this. And he goes into talking about how technology, we're told, only harms those menial, manual labor people. You know, those tedious factory jobs. You know, that we can either mechanize or we can send to China for a kid to do for 8 to 10 cents an hour. But he's talking about computers, how the computers are taking away legal research and all of these high-skilled jobs that people train their entire lives to do. And he says quite a lot of work currently carried out by well-educated, relatively well-paid workers may soon be computerized. So we're going to see the next phase of workers lost in this. And you look at all of this competition, all of this scenario that we've been put into. We've been saddled with trade agreements that destroy our jobs. We've been saddled with trade agreements that put us in unwinnable situations. We keep telling our kids that education is the way to go, even though we know mechanization is going to kill them. And I look at the kids of today, and I ask, will the kids of this generation revolt? Will we see the kind of protests like we saw in Wisconsin across this nation? You got to understand, Republicans are gutting the opportunity for these kids to have a better future under the guise that they're getting their economic house in order. When Corbett takes the stage tomorrow, he's going to tell the kids, sorry that your tuition's going to skyrocket, but I'm doing this to restore fiscal sanity. Sorry, Mom and Dad. We're going to have you pay higher tuition, and your kids are going to get saddled with more debt, if your kids can get that debt. There's going to be no more student aid. Wait until enough of them have graduated and have nowhere to go, because we have outsourced all these jobs. We've mechanized all these jobs, and we've allowed business to do what business does. Cut costs, create profit. And I look to this. I look to this younger generation. And I ask, what are they going to do? This younger generation, they're not isolated. They talk to each other. In large numbers, they talk to each other. On things like Facebook and Twitter and things we get to even hear of. And the reality is, they've seen what those things can do in places like Egypt and in Wisconsin. So the question I have is, what are they going to do to secure their future? Because these budgets, these massive, enormous budget cuts, are their future. The more we tear down, the more we destroy government, the more they're going to have to clean up. The more they're going to have to care for their parents in old age, because we're going to steal their retirement and their Social Security. And we know it's coming, Jake. We absolutely know that the day is coming when they allow the states to go bankrupt so they don't have to pay pension obligations. We know what they're going to do with Social Security if they get the chance, which is why you got to fight back.
And the Republicans, especially in the last 30 years since Ronald Reagan, have been masters at that, Rick. They've taken a crisis that really has nothing to do with their panacea, and they've gone directly to the programs which they abhorred, directly to the programs which they did not like and wanted to eliminate, and they went straight at them. Didn't matter if it made sense. Didn't matter if it was fair or just. But they were very good at persuading enough people that this is what has to be done for the sake of the country.
You know, we've been told time and time again, education. Go get a college degree. But where are the jobs? We're not investing anymore. We're just not doing it. And corporate America has walked away from this country because of the lack of investment. And because they can do it cheaper elsewhere. Because we just don't have the will. This is what I'm hoping for Wisconsin. I'm hoping Wisconsin is that moment in our history where we say this is the catalyst that woke up the American working class, where we demanded a middle class existence, where we demanded education. This is our civil rights fight. This is our future fight. They want to steal education. They want to privatize it so they can profit from it and they can take it away. And the question is, are you going to let them? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Working class majority. Rick Smith.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's autocratic attempt to abrogate the democratic right of public employees to bargain with their governmental bosses is not wearing well with the public. Recent polls show that a mere one-third of Wisconsinites favor his blatantly political power play, and that if he had told voters in last year's election that he intended to do this, he would have lost. After only 1 month in office, Walker's approval rating has plummeted, and he's become a national poster boy for right-wing anti-union extremism. Indeed, he's so out of step that he's even being jeered by democracy fighters in Egypt. Yet, Walker is but one of a flock of far-right corporate-crested Republican governors and Congress critters who are waging an all-out class war on unionized workers. It's a shameful effort to bust the wage structure and legal protections that support America's already endangered middle class. In Washington, for example, loopy GOP leaders are out to abolish the legal mechanism through which workers can form a union and have their bargaining rights protected. Meanwhile, war-whooping Republican governors in Ohio, New Jersey, Indiana, and elsewhere are slashing the health care and pension benefits owed to public employees, blaming these middle-class workers for their state's fiscal misses. But state budgets have been depleted by the economic crash caused by Wall Street greed and massive tax giveaways to wealthy elites, not by a firefighter's pension or a teacher's health plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, and check out Nevada, where the Chamber of Commerce is even pushing to eliminate the minimum wage. This corporate-funded Republican assault is not about fiscal responsibility. The corporate powers intend nothing less than to dismantle the entire framework of America's economic democracy and return us to the dark days of robber baron plutocracy. To the barricades, people!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
One 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, right there for you to download for your entertainment, your enjoyment, your convenience, if you will. Also, you can email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. They had a big four-day bus tour. The people at Americans for Prosperity, they broke out the decked-out buses with the beautiful decals and all the amenities. $150,000-$200,000 a piece, and they rolled the buses around on a 10-city tour of Wisconsin, and they wound up in Madison on Sunday. And who did they bring with them?
They brought Joe, the unlicensed plumber. And I'm going, has anybody's stock in the political arena fallen as far as Joe, the unlicensed plumber? You know, the fact of the matter is the guy is basically a scumbag. He doesn't have a job, and he should hate John McCain. He should be the guy who, I don't know, maybe getting a 10 grand from the Koch brothers to give a halfway speech at one of these idiotic rallies. Maybe that's easier than snaking out a drain. Especially when you're an unlicensed plumber and you really don't have the credentials to do it. You're a scab plumber. So maybe McCain saved him from a life of just playing with pipes. You know, there's a difference between being an actual plumber and just a guy who plays with pipes. And I look at Joe, the unlicensed plumber, as a guy who just plays with pipes.
Who we talked to when he was here in Harrisburg. Decent guy, not very well informed. Probably the situation is, Rick, he was available, so they took who they could get.
He's a puppet.
Absolutely.
You know, he's a puppet for the Koch brothers.
I mean, our one friend that calls in, Rick, the airline pilot, said he ran into him one of the flights. You know,
trying to hit on the waitress, on the stewardesses with, hey, I'm Joe, the unlicensed plumber.
Well, he had a heart to heart, and Joe basically said, hey, you got to strike while the iron's hot. He wants to make as much money. I think they were even talking about a book. I mean, that shows you how far our literary tastes have gone in this country.
Would that be a pop-up book?
Oh, boy, would that be a wow. I can't sleep, Rick. I just can't sleep till that comes out.
Anyway, the unlicensed plumber went to the Alliant Energy Center there in Madison, Wisconsin, where a couple hundred people showed up. Now, look, you had a couple hundred people show up in the Stand Against Spending, Stand with Walker rally. But across town at the Capitol, you had 30,000 people saying, you know what, we don't buy it. And it's interesting, you only got a couple hundred people out there, and most of them were paid. You look at Joe, the unlicensed plumber, who got a nice chunk of change to fill his pocket, as most of those folks do. And the Koch brothers, they spend a good chunk of change to put on these little news events so that their news channels, so that their media can cover it. And, you know, I found it interesting. And if you go and you look at a lot of the stuff that's going on recently, the T Twizzlers get equal time. So you've got 100,000 people marching on the Capitol there in Madison, Wisconsin. They get 2 minutes. You got three nitwits with a misspelled sign. They get 2 minutes. Somehow I'm just not seeing the fair and balanced. 100,000? Three. Amazing, amazing stuff. In Indiana, the union groups are planning a rally on Thursday. Thousands of people are expected to attend to the We Are Indiana rally between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. at the State House. Also tomorrow, they're planning to mourn the death of the middle class with a New Orleans-style funeral procession. Look, you know, as this stuff pops up, and we're going to be doing stuff here, I think, we've got to think of some of this stuff to get people the opportunity to come out and be involved. Because ultimately, it's going to take everybody in this area and everybody in this state to stop what is coming tomorrow morning. And we'll know exactly what's going to happen tomorrow morning, but I'm telling you right now, there are deep, painful cuts. At a time when we don't really need these deep, painful cuts. And you know, I go back to what we saw in Wisconsin, and people have asked me, what was it like? And maybe you'll agree. For me, it was almost a religious experience. It's almost that, that cleansing of the soul. I mean, it was one of those rejuvenative, times where I began to have faith in humanity again. Yes.
Rejuvenation is an excellent word. You know, it's a tough struggle, and you and I and a lot of people in this country have been fighting it every day, and it's a long, hard, tough struggle. And there are some times when you get depressed, but these are one of these times when you can say, wow, it just renewed my faith. It's a beautiful, beautiful exhibition of people sticking together and every day just showing an immense amount of determination and energy. It's literally something that I think you and I will always remember.
I know I will, because the reality is I look at this and you know, I talked to those people who in the 60s were part of the universities being shut down, part of cities being shut down, these massive protests against the Vietnam War. And I see this as big, if not bigger, in that this is our existence. This is our way of life being attacked by the people we've given a whole bunch of money to. By the Koch brothers, by the Mellenscaifes, by the Coors, by the Olins, by the Mars, by all of these very, very wealthy donors to conservative think tanks and conservative causes. And there's nothing really conservative about what they do. I would say it's not conservatism, it's radicalism. They are out not to conserve what is great about our country, not to conserve education, not to conserve resources, not to conserve our democracy, but they're out to destroy. They're out to destroy our education system and our democracy and our way of life. And, you know, I get this all the time, you know, this, well, you know, Rick, I think you're exaggerating. No. Look at what's happened to the working class of this country over the last 30 years. You used to have a vibrant, growing middle class that had disposable income, that could afford to take a vacation, that could afford to have one parent working, that could afford to buy a new car every now and again, that could afford some of the luxuries in life, and could afford to take time off. Oh, I don't know, to watch their kids play baseball, to participate in PTA, to go to school functions. We used to have a value in that. It seems now, though, all we value is creating a billionaire class, a class of people so wealthy, so entitled, so self-absorbed, and so separated from the rest of society that they have no clue what it is to be you or me. They have no clue. They have no clue what it is to sweat out a bill. They have no idea what it's like to worry if you're going to be able to pay the rent or be able to put food on the table. They have no idea. And when I hear people saying, you know, well, I just want government to run like I run my kitchen table. And I say, well, government doesn't run that way. They never have. And it's too simplistic, folks. But I guess that's what we've been sold.
You know, I have to let me say two things. First of all, I think what people have to understand is you have to draw the line in the sand somewhere. You have to make a stand. It's like in a battle when you're running away from the battle, so to speak, at least metaphorically. But sometimes you got to stop running and you got to set up a defense line. You got to say, I will not. This is where I'm going to live. This is where I'm going to stand, and I'm either going to live or die, at least metaphorically. If our enemies win this, they'll keep going. There is nothing like ultimate victory for these people. They want to go back literally 100 years. They do want to privatize Social Security. They do want to privatize Medicare. They do want to eliminate prevailing wage. They do want to eliminate minimum wage. They want to eliminate all the progress that was made by the middle class because they don't believe it. And those who have the money and the power will not stop. We're going to have to stop them. They're not going to stop on their own. You can't win the argument with these people on moral grounds of what's right and wrong. It's purely about power. Another point I want to make. They try to fool the American people when they showed that film where there was a, out in California, where there was a confrontation with a union member and, someone else, they got in an argument.
You mean that union thug?
Unfortunately, there were palm trees in it. Not too many palm trees, the last I checked, growing in Wisconsin. But the point is, all those days, Rick, you and I know, we marveled at it, how peaceful and considerate those people were. I didn't even see people arguing. Not once. I know that's hard to believe. Not once, and I saw an interview by, I think, a guy from Fox News, and, you know, there was people surrounding him. Of course, they were interested, and his one assistant from Fox News, he handed a piece of paper across, and I don't know if he accidentally or deliberately bumped into somebody. Right away, he accuses them of assault. What I'm trying to say is they did everything in their power to try to say that, well, this was just a rally by union hooligans. No, it wasn't. There were a lot of non-union people. There were children there. This was an outpouring of the community from across Wisconsin. Wow. And it was beautiful to see. It was peaceful. Well, it was
Fox
it
News.
Was nonviolent. It's exactly the kind of protest that we better hope in this country is the kind of protest we have. Because if the problems of this country aren't addressed, God help us, but it could degenerate into something more.
Fox News, if it's not there, we'll make it up.
Exactly.
We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Every morning at the mine, you could see him arrive. He stood 6'6" and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder and narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John. Big John.
Big John. Big John Boner. House Speaker John Boner. He loves this whole "we're broke" frame. And you gotta kind of laugh. He loves to say we're broke and we're going bankrupt. He spews that frame ad nauseum. The only problem is according to Bloomberg, he's dead wrong. And what they're saying is Mark Chandler, the global head of the currency strategies at Brown Brothers. Wasn't that Prescott Bush's old place? Grandpappy Bush? Yeah, I do believe it was. Anyway, he says the U.S. government is not broke. There's no evidence that it is broke. And there's no evidence that the market is treating the U.S. government like it's broke. In fact, the U.S. is able to borrow at historically low rates, 0.6% on a two-year note. Before the crisis, in 2007, we were paying about 5.1%. So think about that for a second. Bloomberg also points out that financial products that pay off if Uncle Sam defaults, they're not attracting anyone either. In fact, they go through and talk about the countries that are in big trouble, like Venezuela, who are paying somewhere like $1.2 million on a $10 million note, as where we're paying just $45,000. So just for this insurance, because you've got to insure these bonds. The part that I found interesting in the whole Bloomberg piece and really caught my attention, it said tax revenues as a percentage of the economy is at a 60-year low, meaning if the government needs to raise cash, it can summons the political will to do so. We are at a 60-year low. And, you know, folks, that's what I've been saying for the longest time. We got time. Let's go to the phone lines. Got James on line one. How are we doing tonight, James?
Pretty good. My thing is this. Do you think this budget could be another one of those situations where enough people in Pennsylvania realize just what they voted for?
I'm hoping.
Okay. The other question is, I don't know if this exists, but is there such a thing as a progressive caucus within the Pennsylvania state legislature?
I do not know. Other than Daylon Leach, I don't think so.
Okay, because...
So, yes, I'll say Daylon Leach is the chairman and the member of the Progressive Caucus.
Maybe Pasquale. Maybe DePasquale.
Okay, maybe.
Well, what I mean is that is there a formal...
Not to my knowledge. Not like there is in the U.S. House, no.
Could this budget be something that would maybe... for either those within the legislature or perhaps from outside, you know, maybe groups like Keystone Progress and Penn Future maybe start pushing for it.
That's an interesting thought. I would just like the Democrats to stick together as a whole. Like, at some point, they've got to realize that they're in the shark tank with the rest of us, and this guy is going to steamroll over everyone if they don't figure out how to stand in unison. And like the guy in Wisconsin, what you're finding is the Democrats there are finally coming together and they're finally watching each other's back. I'm hoping that happens here. So if having a progressive caucus means that a couple of people get together, I'm in favor of it, but I would rather see the whole party kind of close ranks a little bit and defend the working class values of this state.
I just wanted to throw that out. And also, as we get further along in the process, what would the possibilities be of you setting up shop at the Midtown Scholar again?
I would love to do that. Problem is, we do a 9 to midnight show. I don't know how late he's open.
I will let you know this. I remember during the elections, they actually had an event where they closed the store. Where they had it after hours and they closed the store. Or could there be another? I don't know if there's any. You know, I forgot that you keep different hours now.
Yeah, I would love to, and I like Eric. I think Eric would make a good county commissioner as well.
I forgot he's. Yeah, I forgot he's running.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
Alrighty, well, as I said, it'll be interesting to hear what you have to say tomorrow.
It's going to be interesting to hear what Tom Corbett's got to say.
Well, hey. That too, but it's going to be okay. Let's put it this way: it's going to be interesting to hear what you have to say about what Tom Corbett has to say.
There you go. I appreciate that, James.
Alrighty, bye bye.
Thank you, brother. And look, at the end of all of this. The reality is what he's going to say tomorrow, I do think, as James said, I think it's going to ignite people. I think it's going to ignite groups like Keystone Progress, like Penn Future, like Penn Action, like, you know, the number of groups that are out there to finally begin to throw in and say, we need to start marching on the Capitol. We need to start engaging people, doing the hard work of organizing. We need to do this. And there are going to be a lot of groups who are going to be very interested in throwing in because it's their skin. It's their behind in this game. And look, this whole argument that somehow we're broke, this whole argument, this frame that the right wants to keep throwing out there, They love to tell the story, and Boner's aide reiterated it in this article. He says, if an American family is spending more money than they're taking in year after year, they're broke. And I say, no, they're not broke. Broke is broke. Broke is no money in your pocket, no money for food, no money on the table, nothing. That's broke. We're okay, and Bloomberg agrees. Writing a person, company, or nation would be defined as broke if it couldn't pay its bills. We don't have that problem. We're doing okay. We're paying our bills. All of this rhetoric, all of this heated rhetoric is designed to get us to look at each other with a jaundiced eye, to point fingers at each other. That's what this is about. It's not about effective government. It's not about a better tomorrow. It's not about creating jobs. It's not about a middle class. They don't care about any of those things. They never have. What they care about? Profit in their pockets. What they care about? Profit in the Koch brothers' pockets. Campaign donations from the Koch brothers. And the Scaifes and the Olins and all of them. You know, Michael Moore had an interesting quote. He said, America's not broke. Not by a long shot. The country is awash in wealth and cash. It's just that it's not in your hands. It's been transferred in the greatest heist in history. From the workers and consumers to the banks and the portfolios of the uber rich, today just 400 Americans have more wealth than half of all Americans combined. And that's nothing new, and it's nothing new that Michael Moore said it, because I've said it a thousand times. But you stop and think about 400 people. You can put into a pretty good-sized room. They've got a greater share of the economic pie of this nation, the wealthiest nation in the history of civilization. They've got a greater share than 150 million people. Think about the magnitude of that. Think about the sheer gluttony in that. And yet they tell us we have to have these job creators. Well, where are these job creators? We have to have these people, and we need to give them more in the hopes that, you know, maybe they'll create more jobs. But have they? And the answer is no. Where they have created jobs, and I go back to John McCain saying low-wage countries prevail over high-wage countries. Well, where have the quote-unquote job creators gone? They've gone to low-wage countries. And why have they done that? Because we've allowed them. So what they then do is they tell us, say, all you Tea Party people, blame those unions. You know, the people who brought you the weekend. You know, the people who bought your vacation, the people who brought you health care, people who brought you safety on the job, people who brought you rights and a voice on the job, people who brought you a whole plethora of other things, child labor laws, maximum hours, minimum wage, all of those things. Born out of the labor movement, born out of the blood, sweat, and tears of working people of the past. They want you to forget all of that. And they want you to focus on one or two bad apples, one or two well-chosen situations that are not the norm. And that's what they want you to focus on. Because they don't want you to see the 800-pound gorilla behind the curtain, which is the Koch brothers, which is all of this massive accumulation of wealth by the handfuls at the expense of you and me. At the expense of our children. So when they tell us tomorrow, and Corbett will tell us, time to tighten the belt. I have to be the adult in the room. We have a spending problem, he's going to say, I'll bet you. We have a spending problem. And I'm telling you, we got a revenue problem. And the revenue problem is that we've given people who gave Corbett money too much money. We've given away too much to the top. And it's time to reclaim it. That's what we should be talking about. When we come back, we're going to talk with Abe Amoros, Legislative Director for the Laborers International Union, LIUNA, right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Michigan is joining Wisconsin, Indiana, and Ohio in vigorous resistance to a national assault on working families. Doug Cunningham files this report.
United Auto Workers President Bob King says workers everywhere must rise up against a coordinated national attack on collective bargaining rights for workers. The UAW and allies will rally at Lansing March 14th to protest Michigan Republican Governor Snyder taking away collective bargaining rights for 70,000 home health care workers. The UAW is also protesting a slash-and-burn budget in Michigan that takes from working families and gives to the rich and corporations.
There is an agenda. There's a strategy being done across America by the Republican Party to destroy the middle class in America. And if we don't stand up and fight this, whether it's in Michigan or Wisconsin or Ohio or any other state in the union, we're not going to have a middle class. And we're not going to have workers having the democratic right, the freedom of association, freedom of speech. And that's what being a union is a part of. We believe very strongly that budgets are moral documents. Don't say you care about families and then pass budgets that destroy families.
Last week, the Ohio Senate passed Bill SB 5, which attacks the right of workers to collectively bargain. Unlike a similar bill proposed in the state of Wisconsin, the Ohio legislation additionally removes the right of firefighters and law enforcement to collectively bargain. The state's assembly is expected to take up the bill this week. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan took to the floor of the House of Representatives last week and said the legislation proposed in his home state is unfair and undermines American values.
Firefighters who go into burning buildings when we're all running out of them, police officers who we call up when we're in trouble, or teachers that we ask in many instances to spend more time with our kids than we do, somehow push the blame of the major financial meltdown that happened because of Wall Street recklessness? Blame the teachers for that?
Ryan added that budgeting priorities in Ohio seem to be out of line.
We have the top person who works for the current administration get a $40,000 pay increase from what the last governor was paying, and the secretaries and the people in the mailroom get a cut, and the firefighters and the police and the teachers get a cut. While all this is going on in Ohio, they want to cut the estate tax for the wealthiest people who live in the state of Ohio and ask the teacher to make the sacrifice.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, I could use a sledgehammer. We could smash open that piggy bank on Wall Street, take our money back, according to the people over at Too Much Online, the Too Much Online blog. Corporations in the United States are currently sitting on $2 trillion in cash and short-term investments. Dollars, they say, that could be invested in creating, jobs, be recharging the economy, they say. About $2 trillion, notes Jack Metzger of the Chicago Center for Working Class Studies, also represents the additional dollars full-time workers would be annually earning. Now think about this. This is what he's saying is this is what full-time workers would be annually earning if we're getting the same share of the gains from productivity as workers received in the 30 years after World War II. So had our wages, as they had from World War II up until the early 70s, kept up with productivity, that would be our $2 trillion. So in other words, that's our money. They are sitting on our money, and we're paying them. We are paying them for the honor of hoarding our money. Good for us. Amazing. Anyway, tomorrow is going to be a big day, and here to give us a preview of what his thoughts are, a longtime Democratic strategist and current legislative director over at the Laborers International Union, LIUNA. Abe Amoros, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
I'm looking, as you know, they say, the day of reckoning. Kind of an Armageddon feeling I have.
I got to tell you, I have the same one, and I think that working families are going to be in for a little bit of a surprise tomorrow. This governor and his administration has been extraordinarily tight-lipped for the past several months, for the last several weeks on what this budget is going to look like. And when leaders try to press him, he's evasive. His staff has been evasive. His administrative team has given a whole lot out there in terms of what's going to be taking place tomorrow. So we're all waiting with bated breath until 11:30 a.m. tomorrow when he makes that address. And from what I gathered and what I've seen and what I've read, we're looking at about $2.6 billion in cuts. Education is going to take a hit, and I'm afraid that working families are going to do the same.
Screwed again. You know, I look at people like Walker out in Wisconsin and Christie in New Jersey, and you go, yeah, they're dangerous, and they're more dangerous because they're kooky. But I look at our guy. I'm more afraid of him because he doesn't appear to be the crazy.
That's right. He doesn't appear to be the crazy, and he's saying the right things. He's saying things like, well, Wisconsin's not going to happen here in Pennsylvania because you're too strong. You have too many union members. You have too many working class families. And those are the kinds of comments that make me a little bit nervous, and it should be a call to all of us to organize even more and be more proactive in the way we approach things. And this is the time that we need to go to see our legislators and have them put pressure on the governor to make sure that that doesn't happen, because those are just words right now. And if the movement continues eastward, I'm afraid that Pennsylvania is going to get zapped also, and we just can't have it. This is not the right time for us to be worrying about a copycat of Wisconsin.
You know, I look at people like Representative Turdzai and Representative Metcalf, and they're kind of being pushed out there by the media, and I think to a degree by the administration as the extreme. Here's the dancing fools, if you will. I'm not as crazy as they are, but I think he's almost there with them.
I agree, and you know, when you use those kinds of smoke screens, that's when you know the wheels are turning and conversations are taking place and legislation is being written that is going to be harmful to us, because they're using those guys as the example of the most extreme scenario. And what they'll do is they'll temper that, and then they'll give us something that's not as extreme, and they'll try to make it appear as if it's not that bad for us. But At the end of the day, it will still be harmful to working families, no doubt about it.
So let's look at some of the things that, you know, they're talking about: deep, drastic cuts to education that we're assuming are going to happen. Cuts to state programs, cuts to museums and state parks, and a lot of things going to roll onto the back of the taxpayer on the local level through higher property taxes and less services. College students appear to be on the chopping block. Do we see somewhere down the road the kind of citizen activism that we're seeing in states like Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana? Can we in Harrisburg see that?
Yes, we can see that. And I think we've started to see some of that last week. There was a rally of working families that were interested in making sure that the scenario in Wisconsin was not repeated here. And I think that we really need to wake up our citizenry and all the working families, not just those in labor, and let them know that they're coming. They're coming to get us. And unless we stand up and say, wait a minute, we don't want that kind of presence here, and put our legislators on notice, then we're going to have a problem. But right now what I'm seeing is more citizens awakening, which is a good thing. But it's not enough. We need to do a little bit more to make sure that those people understand that these cuts are going to be draconian in some instances, and they're going to have to shell out more dollars. And, you know, one of the things that he said, Rick, one of the things that the governor said was there will be no new taxes tomorrow unveiled, but let's see how many things are closed down that are going to cost money in the end. Let's see how many user fees are going to be imposed as a result of these measures. That's where the problems are going to come in. I mean, the old saying, the devil's in the details,
right,
is going to really come into play tomorrow at 11:30 a.m.
And it's going to come down to the local level. The governor's going to have his political cover. He's not going to have a George Bush moment. He is going to get his political cover. Now, the folks downhill, because like I was saying earlier, it, rolls downhill.
Yes, sir.
And at the bottom of it is, are you and me, the taxpayers, through higher fees, as you pointed out, through higher taxes. Oh, we're going to pay the bill anyway. And my problem with that is, there are people in our state and there are people in this country who have walked away from their responsibility. You know, as the one article I pointed out, we have a 60-year low of tax revenues. We don't have a spending problem, in my opinion. We have a massive revenue problem.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. So what they do is they take these sound bites and they use them for political purposes. They use them to scare people, or they use them to make them feel better. So the governor's going to stand up there tomorrow and say, no new taxes. Well, we're going to get the short end of the stick no matter what he says tomorrow, because these cuts that we're looking at are absolutely draconian. I mean, scary, scary things. And you hit the nail on the head. We don't have enough revenues coming in to cover, and that's what's going to force senior citizens to get hurt, school children to get hurt, and working families to get hurt. We can't continue to keep cutting programs. They're already cut to the bone. And some of the community services that you just mentioned are really on the chopping block. So, again, tomorrow is going to be key. It's going to be one of the most important budget addresses in recent history, as far as I can remember anyway. And there are going to be a lot of people with their knees shaking as soon as he begins that address, because by the end of it, we're going to really see what kind of pain we're in for.
Yeah. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Abe Amoros, Legislative Director for the Laborers International Union, LIUNA. You know, Abe, there's a sadistic part of me that, you know, back in 2008 said we needed to have a collapse. We needed to have mass pain. We needed people who were going to suffer for a little bit of time. You know, the old sayings, you know, your stomach's got to be empty before your head gets right. So I'm looking at this with, you know, in the sadistic part of me saying, you know, maybe this is the medicine we in the working class need. Maybe we need to see just how far down the scorched earth path they will take us before we wake up and turn around.
Brother, you're exactly right. And I think this is going to be a wake-up call for a lot of people throughout the entire Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. There's no question that what is going to be unveiled tomorrow is going to harm people in a very real way. And right now, maybe our bellies are grumbling a little bit, but by the end of that address tomorrow, they're going to be making a lot of noise. You're going to feel a lot of pain. And I'm going to be very interested to see what the news clippings and analyses say throughout the rest of the week on how bad this is going to be for Pennsylvanians. And, you know, it's going to be on the it's going to be a burden on the Republican Party to find out how they can fix this if things are that bad. And with them in the majority, I'd like to see what they do. But you know what? We have to be vigilant. We have to make them accountable. And as you said, we are in a position right now where things are so bad that it's finally going to be a wake-up call. And I know that what you prophesized may sound harsh, but the truth of the matter is it has to happen. These things are cyclical, and I think that what you're going to see tomorrow is a call to action more than anything else to stop some of those draconian measures so then the legislature can deliberate in the next several months as they hold their budget hearings throughout March and ask hard, difficult questions of those administrators that they're going to be interviewing. The Senate has its hearings and the House has its hearings and the appropriations committees. They're going to start on every department, and the tough questions are going to have to be asked. So what is printed tomorrow doesn't have to be finalized until the end of June.
Right.
July 1st is the deadline.
Will it be on time?
I got to tell you, Rick, I think it will be on time. I don't think that this Republican legislature...
It better be on time.
Yes. I'd like to think that it's for the benefit of the taxpayers, but the cynic in me says they're going to pass this budget on time. A Republican House and a Republican Senate are going to pass this thing on time to not embarrass the Republican governor.
Right.
And to say, look at this. For the last 8 years, we couldn't pass a budget under a Democratic governor, and now we're going to pass a budget on time with a Republican governor.
Yeah, we're going to railroad you.
Smoke and mirrors.
We're going to railroad you on time.
Exactly. We're going to railroad you on time, and you're going to like it. That's the message that they're going to send to the people of Pennsylvania. And we have to say that's not acceptable, And that's, this is a time where we have to start making noise and really, really doing our part to be citizen activists.
You know, I look at last week. On Tuesday, the governor allowed adult basic to go by the wayside,
yep.
Kicking some 42,000 people to the curb. No health care for these low-income workers. Yet on Friday, he comes out with a massive tax break for corporations. You know, I look at budgets as a moral document. It's going to show your priorities. And I really do think we will see the morality, the family values, the characteristics of conservatism on Tuesday.
Absolutely. What he did on Friday was absolutely unconscionable. With so many people out of work, with so many people without health care, and so many people unable to make ends meet, here he goes and gives a $200 million break to the wealthiest corporations in Pennsylvania and says we ought to be doing more of that so then these corporations can stick around, they can grow and create jobs. Well, where are those jobs? Where are they coming in from? And are they being given to Pennsylvanians? The answer is no. They're nowhere to be found just yet. And we have to make them accountable. We have to say, we know exactly what you're doing. Knock it off. And we have 2 years to really dig in and make this legislature aware of the fact that we've had it. We're not going to go down this path, and there are going to be changes next year.
Yeah, well, I hope so, and I hope this wakes some folks up. I hope the people who are affected by this take to the streets, because that's the only way things change.
That's right.
That's it. Abe Amoros, Laborers International Union, Legislative Director. I appreciate your time, brother. Always great to talk to you. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. Likewise. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's autocratic attempt to abrogate the democratic right of public employees to bargain with their governmental bosses is not wearing well with the public. Recent polls show that a mere one-third of Wisconsinites favor his blatantly political power play, and that if he had told voters in last year's election that he intended to do this, he would have lost. After only 1 month in office, Walker's approval rating had plummeted, and he's become a national poster boy for right-wing anti-union extremism. Indeed, he's so out of step that he's even being jeered by democracy fighters in Egypt. Yet, Walker is but one of a flock of far-right, corporate-crested Republican governors and Congress critters who are waging an all-out class war on unionized workers. It's a shameful effort to bust the wage structure and legal protections that support America's already endangered middle class. In Washington, for example, Luthi GOP leaders are out to abolish the legal mechanism through which workers can form a union and have their bargaining rights protected. Meanwhile, war-whooping Republican governors in Ohio, New Jersey, Indiana, and elsewhere are slashing the health care and pension benefits owed to public employees, blaming these middle-class workers for their state's fiscal messes. But state budgets have been depleted by the economic crash caused by Wall Street greed and massive tax giveaways to wealthy elites, not by a firefighter's pension or a teacher's health plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, and check out Nevada, where the Chamber of Commerce is even pushing to eliminate the minimum wage. This corporate-funded Republican assault is not about fiscal responsibility. The corporate powers intend nothing less than to dismantle the entire framework of America's economic democracy and return us to the dark days of robber baron plutocracy. To the barricades, people!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. For all of our podcasters, feel free to give us your thoughts, comments, questions, ideas. I do appreciate it, and I do answer all emails personally. Thanks so much for tuning in. You go back to what Hightower was talking about this idea that the pension benefits that state workers got they're too generous. You hear this often. They're just too generous. We just can't afford them anymore. They're too generous because they're out of whack with the private sector. For me, the problem is the private sector is out of whack with a middle class existence. You are basically you're at the mercy of Wall Street. If it tanks, so does your retirement. You know, the idea of a retirement plan was that you would have some security in old age. You said, I will give up some wages right now. I'm going to defer my compensation right now and going to have you take those wages, put it into a fund so that when I retire for the rest of my life, I will receive a set amount of money. And it's nothing astronomical. My grandmother, I think, gets like $800 a month. I've seen some retirement plans where they go up to $3,000 a month, maybe a little bit more, but very, very infrequently do you see much more than that. And what they want us to believe, that by having this kind of security, somehow that's anti-American. Somehow they want us to believe that these crappy 401ks that they rammed down our throats back in the 80s, that's the natural course of thing. And I love this. I just love this. The private sector has decided that that's what the people want. And I go, really? Did the private sector really decide that? Or was it just something that was shoved down their throat? Because I got to be honest, Jake, I don't remember being part of that memo chain where they said, gee, private sector worker, which would you like? Would you like 401ks or defined benefits? And I don't remember people voting. I just don't.
The mailman must have missed my house that week. If I could comment on state workers and their pensions.
You mean those generous retirement benefits?
Well, first of all, compensation levels I don't care if it's Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Ohio, Wisconsin. They are less. Depending on your educational level that's required, depending on the skill level, I think the higher you go, in fact, I know the numbers I saw, the higher you go, the more skill, the more education that is needed, the greater disparity. So as far as pay, state workers have always taken less. That's a given. But one thing state workers could expect, and for the most part have gotten, they've gotten good health care at a reasonable price and a reasonable, and you explained it, a reasonable retirement. And when you negotiate, it's a pie. I don't know if any of our listeners have ever negotiated, but for the most part, there's a pie there. And you negotiate how you're going to carve up that pie. And state workers, for the most part, have leaned towards health care. For a long time, they didn't pay anything. They do pay something now. And a decent retirement. You have to understand, it's not something that was given free. Many times it was in lieu of a raise. Which, who does that help? That helped the taxpayers of the state.
And it helped the politician.
And it helped the politician.
You kept pushing that can down the
Correct.
Road.
Correct. And retirement, you have to understand, the way the federal law is stated, and I'm sure the state has the same fiduciary responsibilities. You can wait to put most of that money in the back end.
Right.
So there's all kinds of flexibility that gave the taxpayers. It saved the taxpayers money in the long run. The average person doesn't understand it. And in Pennsylvania, it's even worse. You and I both know the politicians gamble. Now there's a first. Politicians looking out for their career above the welfare of the taxpayer. There's a first. Let me sit down on that one.
Well, here's the thing. McClatchy is saying that, you know, there's simply no evidence that state pensions are causing a burden for the public finances. And they go and they talk about this stuff, a study by the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. They say that the pension contributions from state and local employers aren't blowing up the budgets. They amount to just 2.9% of state spending on average. Now, the Center for Retirement and Research out of Boston College puts that a bit higher at 3.8. Now, you compare that to the private sector, the nonpartisan Employee Benefit Research Institute, who estimates retirement funding in the private sector at 3.5% of employees' contributions or compensation. So you're looking at this and you're going, well, they're actually comparable, and in some cases the private sector's higher. The difference is in the private sector they threw that money into these 401k schemes, and now people are losing it. And they say, look, and McClatchy points this out, that the pension funds aren't broke. They're underfunded, yes, but that's because of, that's because of the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009. All of the investments are down. Everybody's down. And Republicans love to put this frame out there that, and you hear it with Social Security all the time, Jake, that, well, you know, in 2037, it ends, it stops, it's done. We only have enough money to get to 2037. That's the end of the world. Yeah, we're going broke. We're broke, and it'll stop. It's gone. The problem is, that's not true. It's not true at all. We pay a lesser benefit. They're saying somewhere between 75-80%. And then it gradually goes down from there. But it doesn't just stop.
But they forget one big thing, Rick. That's if we do nothing.
And
which is highly unlikely.
It's highly likely because the Republicans aren't going to do anything to save a program that they've been against from the beginning. They're going to do everything in their power to muck this up even worse.
Well, we got 25 years to improve it. I think somewhere along the line, if history repeats itself, and I think it generally does, the Democrats will have an opportunity to improve the system. All it takes is political will and a little foresight.
I don't care who does it, just as long as somebody does. And, you know, the Democrats have, you know, kind of ticked me off a bunch this last year as well. And hopefully this gets them a spine. I don't care who it is who stands up for working people. I just want somebody to do it. And you go back and you look through the years, Labor had supported Republicans in the past. The problem is the Republican Party has gone so far to the extreme. They are so far in the pocket of big business that, to be honest, I'm concerned that they're never going to come back. And, you know, I've told this story before. My government teacher was spot on. You know, you go back to those times in high school where you sat through lectures and you go, this guy's a simpleton. But then you think about it years later and you go, you know, that simpleton was right. And he said, quite frankly, at the end of the day, simplistically put, the Republicans will always be for big business and the wealthy, and the Democrats will always be for big government and the poor. You can make your arguments around that, but it's kind of been the case. And he said, those of you in the middle, you have to decide which you're closest to. Are you closer to being, somebody like Bill Gates, or are you closer to being that homeless guy?
Well, I do believe 2010 was a fair victory for the Republicans. They just happened to be at the right place at the right time. A lot of Democrats stayed home, and people were angry, and they swept them into office. However, by moving to the right, what you're doing is, I believe, we call it the 40-yard line. You know, we always say 30-35% are to the left, 30-35% are to the right, and you have that middle ground, which most of the time decides elections. And I do believe that if the Republicans don't change, that long-term they are going to suffer some long-term damage. And that's the hope that I have. You can see it. Look at John Boehner. I mean, he's afraid to even refute people who are questioning whether Barack Obama is an American citizen. I mean, cut me a break. They are that afraid that they can't even say, well, you know, I personally think he's an American and he's all right, and I would hope that our people would tell him. He doesn't say that. What he says is, well, they have a right to their opinion. Well, of course they have a right, but that doesn't mean that what they're saying is accurate, nor is it for the good of the country. And he won't even challenge him on something that basic. It is absolutely amazing. It amazes me what is happening in this country, especially in the Republican Party. I've never seen it like this.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Peter Buckland, a PhD candidate of educational theory and policy, evidently he's going to be taking a bike ride from his home there in Pine Grove Mills, Center County, to the governor's office. We're going to find out why. We're right back after.
I'm taking all our money and shipping it offshore to the job you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make the way to
happen. Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. You know, our governor took a whole boatload of money from the drilling industry, and the drillers have, you know, they've gotten their payback. They're going to be opening up more state land. There's going to be, in my opinion, less regulation. We're going to see, well, I think we're going to see the coal industry revisited. There are people out there who, you know, for all intent and purposes, they are out there doing something, getting out in the streets. And one of those folks, Peter Buckland, he's a grad student, a PhD candidate at Penn State's College of Education, also the father of three, going to be taking a bike ride from his home in Center County, Pine Grove Mills, to the governor's office here on Wednesday. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rick.
Explain to me why. Why are you doing this?
Well, I believe that we are not being represented effectively by our governor, and not terribly well sometimes by our legislature. Seems to me that, as you just said, the natural gas industry has more or less been able to buy its representation, giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to Tom Corbett's campaign alone, and about $3 million to Pennsylvania campaigns in the last 10 years. I don't have millions of dollars. The people who I know out there who love hunting, fishing, who like clean water, who like good forests, who like having healthy children, most of us can't pull together 20 of our best friends and say, hey, let's get hundreds of thousands of dollars so that we can get the governor to do what we want. So I want some accountability. And for me, I ride my bike in the state forests all over the state every year. And I want those to have integrity, and I want them to be healthy. They filter our water. They give us clean air. And the governor's recent decision to yank the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources ability to do preliminary assessments on new drilling is crazy to me. That acted as a sort of de facto moratorium on new projects, and taking that away, knowing very well his how close he is to the industry, means that these gas companies are going to be able to go in and pilfer our state forests. There's already kind of significant damages with about almost $800,000 or 800,000 acres of leased forest land and parkland out there.
Can you explain what the DCNR is?
The Department of Conservation and Natural Resources is part of the state government that that helps deal with how we're going to handle our natural resources. So part of that, for example, is the Bureau of Forestry. So how should forests be used? How can they be used responsibly? How can they be used so that we can healthily use the forests for our economic benefit, for our social benefit, and for our environmental benefit?
So basically what it is a plan. And what we've done is we've done away with our plan.
Yeah. In a sense, I think that's a really good way to put it. I mean, it sets up a whole way for us to make sure that we have the benefit of what a forest does. In my view, and a lot of other people's views, I mean, think of the number of hunters there are in this state, right? Hundreds of thousands, probably.
Right.
And, I mean, I don't have an official number or something, but there are a lot of people out there who they go into the woods for their livelihood and for their peace of mind. And that's one of the best things about our state. And the governor is dismantling people's ability to do that, to have their own health and well-being. And that's crazy. And
now, I'm going to agree with you, but Peter, all I'm hearing on the news, all I'm hearing in the media is these wonderful Range Resources ads who tell me that there's a farmer out in the middle of nowhere who's happy with a white picket fence, and they're, you know, hey, they made it better than it was. What could be wrong with that?
Well, it's interesting. There was at Penn State, there was a recent conference by the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, and they had some panels on natural gas drilling, and there was a man who came and spoke. He's from southern Pennsylvania, and he said, you know, I have a farm. Having a farm is not an easy life sometimes, and we have made a fair amount of money, and we have not had water problems. Now, that is not true for my neighbors. He has a stream. He gets his water from a stream. But his neighbors have well water. Their well water is contaminated, and they are not seeing the benefit. So, you know, I don't have some official number because the official numbers aren't there because powerful people, more or less, don't want the numbers to be gathered. But for all of the people out there who are getting the big, fat, the shalionaires is what CBS called them. For every shalionaire, you have people with poisoned water who have children who are sick, who have headaches, who may be drinking arsenic or cadmium or barium or natural gas itself. You know, Josh Fox has made a name for himself by showing all of us that, and it wasn't in Pennsylvania, that there are people out there who can light their tap water on fire. That's crazy.
Yeah,
that's totally insane.
Well, what do you say to the reports, in fact, just came out today, that the water treatment facilities that are that's handling this frack water from the drilling show, you know, no increased levels. In fact, they're saying that the levels of radium were at or below normal naturally occurring levels. So, and even, you know, John Hanger, who was the former DEP secretary, mm-hmm. is saying, oh, well, we've done, you know, we've got the strictest regulations in the nation.
Yeah.
When it seems to be everybody's in on this, I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, I think it's really interesting. I heard him speak on the Diane Rehm show, the other day, and he was very defensive, and I don't really blame him. I mean, he was in a pretty rough place with a booming industry, but it seems to me that if you go to the New York Times reports, right, where there are hundreds or thousands of times the level of radium and gross alpha and other radioactive elements in several wastewater treatment plants around the state, that I think that really puts the lie to what some of these people are saying.
Well, what they're saying with this, and I don't want to get into a, you know, into a heated agreement with you here, but what they're saying is that this is journalistic fraud what the New York Times has done, because, you know, these new tests for radium 226 and 228 just weren't there. The high levels just weren't there. So this is their smoking gun that somehow the New York Times was fraudulent.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess that, you know, we can all go back and take our time and you know, try to go do a Freedom of Information Act, request, and then all of us can go and do that. The thing that I think is going on with some of this is defensiveness on Hanger's part, and then also the incredible ability of this industry to just flat out either lie or use a lot of money to divert attention away from real problems. And real problems that we all know are happening.
Absolutely.
You know, you can't just, you know, inject millions of gallons of chemically treated water into the earth at astronomical pressures and then have it come back, call it something else like produced water, and think that that there isn't going to be something wrong with it.
Well,
That's crazy.
We could probably bottle it and sell it.
Oh, yeah. I'm at Penn State, right? The number one party school. Let's start handing out shots.
There you go. Well, let me ask you this, Peter, because, you know, is in your opinion, is there any way of doing this safely? Because, there's two sides to this. There are the people who are saying, you know, we need the industry. This is going to be the transition fuel that's going to get us off the oil. It's going to create jobs in Pennsylvania. There's all this economic activity around it. Do you think there's a way of doing this safely, or I guess I should let you answer the question.
Yeah, probably not, because what has to happen to make frack water is not safe. There is no way that can be safe. And trying to dilute it in wastewater treatment, you know, through by dumping it into a river, for example, like the Monongahela or elsewhere, Susquehanna, Delaware, you can't just dilute super, super toxic stuff.
Right.
So that's one issue. That's not safe. Now, punching a hole in the earth that's 8,000 feet deep and then goes, you know, a half mile or so, you know, horizontally and setting off explosives, right? And then doing that right next to within, you know, several, you know, 20 feet, 50 feet of another one of these, it's going to compromise structural integrity of the cement casing, right? If your listeners are interested, I really encourage them to go look at the presentations and work by Tony Ingraffia, who's at Cornell University. He's been talking a lot about this. You know, there's a lot of stuff that people don't understand. And you brought up, well, this is going to fuel us for the next, it could fuel us for 20 years, right? That's one of the arguments. I would like to know where people are going to fill up their cars with natural gas, because our cars do not run on natural gas. And the transportation infrastructure in this country does not depend on natural gas, right? A lot of people heat their homes.
But I guess you could make the argument that if you had this stuff readily available and there was enough of it, you could conceivably see a transition over to it.
You could. Now, what I want to know is, for your listeners, look at how corporations have treated a place like Nigeria, right? Nigeria, we call it a third world nation. The people who live in Lagos, Nigeria, live like in garbage, okay? Places that are extraordinarily intensely used for natural resource extraction like Nigeria, for oil, are not treated well.
Yeah, I would argue that places like West Virginia are, are not treated
actually,
well.
Actually, I was going to bring up then West Virginia, Western Kentucky. Look at what happened with the Tennessee Valley Authority, right? Those places are turned into the equivalent of third world countries. Pennsylvania is beautiful. It is a verdant state. We have more surface streams than any other state in the lower 48. All right? That's a lot of surface water.
Yep.
And people like it. I live in a mountain gap. I live within probably 150 yards of Slab Cabin Run. I don't want gas migrating into that. Right? And neither does anybody else. But a very few people who can make a ton of money off of this and tell us, oh, we're going to change the infrastructure of the country or something like that. And then what they have done is they have bought politicians and they have bought the access to our governor, right, so that they can do whatever they want. And I'm not going to take it. I'm tired of it.
Well, let's get back to what you're going to do here. I guess on Wednesday the 9th, you're going to start your trek here to the governor's office.
Yep.
110 miles, I understand.
Yeah, it's going to be somewhere between, I haven't actually ridden this route, so it's going to be somewhere between about 105 and 125 miles.
In about 2 minutes, what are you hoping to get out of it?
Well, I know that there are other people who are going to join me there. We will be submitting letters to the governor's office probably around 4 o'clock in the afternoon following a Penn Environment rally. And we are going to request a meeting with him. It says that they have told me that this has to be done in writing, so we will have prepared letters. There will be several of us. We're going to request a meeting. However, several of us have already requested the meeting, and we expect that we will be met then.
I'd be interested to find out what comes of it. I really would.
Great.
Peter Buckland, PhD candidate at Penn State College of Education, also a radio host himself, Sustainability Now Radio, sustainabilitynowradio.blogspot.com.
Right.
There's a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Peter Buckland's name. Peter, I appreciate it. Good luck on the ride, and I wish you the best, brother.
Hey, thanks a lot, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
One place I won't be, I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function, then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, I look at that Marcella Shale thing, and to be honest, you know, it's There are points on both sides. You know, I look at it in, on a one vein. You know, it is an opportunity to get off the foreign oil. It is an opportunity to use as a transition fuel to help fuel our economy, heat our homes, create some jobs. But at the end of it, you know, when you look at West Virginia, when you look at part of Pennsylvania, what the coal industry has left behind, you kind of got to look at it and go, are we creating another coal industry? And there are some who say, you know what, it's economic activity, it's going to create jobs, create wealth, we should be doing it. And then there are folks like Peter Buckland who are saying, look, I love my state. It's a beautiful state. It's a beautiful place to go to the parks and ride and go hunting and do all those, you know, fishing and all those things that people in Pennsylvania have loved for years. And oh, I don't know, drink the water occasionally.
I think we're playing a roulette game here on two fronts here. First of all, the safety of the citizens. Second of all, they're going to be here for a while. They're going to be here for a while, taking that natural gas out of what is perceived as, and I think correctly, the world's biggest supply of natural gas. And if we don't ask them to pay their fair share now, what, some later date we're going to say, oops, well, you know, you got a big debt here. My point is, are they going to really pay the share that they should if we don't get them now when they're making them? And by the way, I understand as this goes on, their profits are going to be less as this process goes on for various reasons. So doesn't it make sense now, when they're probably making as much money as they're going to, doesn't it make sense now to tax them on an ongoing basis? I think it does. And I think you run the risk of letting these people do all this damage and not having to pay for it. And that's a very real possibility.
Well, my concern's always been that I'm going to be the one stuck holding the bag. And we, the taxpayers, should be very,
exactly what I'm
very,
saying.
Very cognizant of the fact that, much like the coal industry, we got stuck holding the bag. The companies up and went bankrupt. They up and left. They, you know, they took the wealth and ran. They created a boom economy and then bust and left. And what was left behind? Well, communities that were ravaged with poverty and destruction. You know, and you know, people love to make light of the fact that there's still a community on fire underneath the ground, and will probably be that way for generations to come.
You know, I think Ed Rendell and a lot of people like to criticize him. They call him Ed Spendell, but you know what? I think he had the right idea. Put a moratorium on it. Let's step back and let's see exactly where we are with this. Let's not give him a free rein, which is basically what we're doing.
Well, what you should have done right from the beginning is you should have been in front of this from the beginning. And we're not. In fact, you're going to be playing catch up for another generation. From the starting, even if we had a governor right now who wanted to rein them in, I don't know that it's possible.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, right? Let's be honest. There were people in the legislature who wanted to do that, but the votes weren't there. The industry did a good job of covering their bases up on the hill. It's called money. Again, money over people.
The money seems to succeed. If you look at today's news, the House passes legislation to lift the controversial residential sprinkler mandate. The Patriot points out, despite an all-out push by the firefighting community and other sprinkler advocates, the State House voted 154-39 to pass legislation lifting the mandate that requires all new one- and two-family homes to include automatic sprinklers. And, of course, the people against it, you know, it was the homeowner, the home builders. It was the insurance industry, you know, which is interesting because the insurance industry, they're the ones who probably would benefit more from having sprinklers. But anyway, the Pennsylvania Building Association was on top of it, saying, look, you know, if people want them, they should be able to install them on their own. Again, I love it, that we give consumers choices. See, again, you know, I go back to what we've been talking about clean energy. You know, had we done back in the late 70s, early 80s, what Carter wanted, which was to make most homes energy independent. We had the technology back then. We have the technology today. All you need are leaders with vision. Our problem is we've got leaders who want to be reelected and reelected and reelected, and they need corporate money to do that. So they're not going to, you know, do anything that has any sense of vision to it whatsoever. For me, you know, again, the building codes, you know, this seems semi-reasonable. But for me, you know, that whole energy independent thing could have been achieved by having all new building standards saying a percentage has to, you have to create, the house has to create a bit of energy. Like you have to put solar panels on it. You have to have, you know, some type of geothermal. You have to have some type of solar hot water, something, something. But we don't do any of that. And it's one of those things that opportunity lost. And again, we've been talking about solar energy. We've been talking about alternative fuels for, well, 40 years now. Mm-hmm. And we're no closer today than we were 40 years ago. In fact, we're worse off today because we're more dependent on foreign oil. We're more dependent on people who hate us than we were 40 years ago. And, you know, where is that a conservative value? I mean, I look at Reagan. I look at Bush. I look at Bush, too. I look at Gingrich. You know, show me what they're all conservative. How can that be? You know, Reagan ran up the doubled the debt, doubled the size of government. Bush did the same thing. I'm kind of confused. How can they all be conservative? What are they conserving? Again, what they're conserving is our wealth into their pockets and into the pockets of their wealthy donors. Simple, simple stuff.
It is amazing, Jimmy Carter. And now if you listen to the talking heads, they mock the man. You know, they mock the man, but yet he was ahead of his time.
Now, granted, I've got problems with Carter. I got problems.
On a certain level,
I got problems with everybody. I got problems with Carter. He signed trucking deregulation.
Deregulation, yes.
The airline industry as well.
Yes.
You know, again, no great. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how we put these people into office who really are not great friends of labor. I think the last really, really good friend of labor would have been Johnson. If you stop and think about the truly visionary things that came out of the Johnson years, the whole war on poverty, the whole Medicare, the Civil Rights Act. I mean, granted, the Vietnam thing kind of put a kibosh on his legacy, but the fact that poverty came down, the fact that, you know, I remember the programs that benefited me and people that I knew to help make people's lives better, those are the kind of vision leaders, you know, visionary leaders I want. People who see the future and say, this is the future that I want for this nation. Well, we've got people right now who all they care about is what's tipping them right in the nose. You know, how much they can stuff into their pockets, how much they can stuff into their corporate donors' pockets.
Well, the irony in 68, not to rehash history, but since you brought it up, in 1968, Richard Nixon ran on a get out of Vietnam platform. Didn't quite make it.
Yeah, but he never believed it.
Well, no, and he never did it either. We were there till really 1973, and the war ended in 1975 when the North Vietnamese overtook the South. I think Johnson, the second term, would have been a good president. I do believe that. Actually, the Democratic candidate, the governor, ex-governor of Minnesota, who was a good man and very strong in labor, would have made a good president. Unfortunately, Richard Nixon was at the right place at the right time. And by the way, at one time, Richard Nixon's political career was dead. He was vice president under Ike Eisenhower. He was also governor of California. I can remember he had a press conference and said, you won't be able to kick Dick Nixon around anymore. And out he came. He reappeared. You know, he obviously was president in 68 and won huge in 72, just an absolute landslide.
But at the end of it, you know, those are people who do not have our interests in mind. And I go back to this. At some point, there has to be some class consciousness. We cannot continue to identify with our captors, if you will. This whole idea, you know, the Stockholm syndrome we all seem to be living under. And you may sound, that sounds crazy, but stop and think about it for a bit. We are being run by a handful of oligarchs, people who have lots and lots of money, who control the message in this country. And until we wake up and begin to say it's time to stand up and fight back, it's going to get worse, and it's going to get much worse. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Thank you.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Michigan is joining Wisconsin, Indiana, and Ohio in vigorous resistance to a national assault on working families. Doug Cunningham files this report.
United Auto Workers President Bob King says workers everywhere must rise up against a coordinated national attack on collective bargaining rights for workers. The UAW and allies will rally at Lansing March 14th to protest Michigan Republican Governor Snyder taking away collective bargaining rights for 70,000 home health care workers. The UAW is also protesting a slash-and-burn budget in Michigan that takes from working families and gives to the rich and corporations.
There is an agenda. There's a strategy being done across America by the Republican Party to destroy the middle class in America. And if we don't stand up and fight this, whether it's in Michigan or Wisconsin or Ohio or any other state in the union, we're not going to have a middle class. And we're not going to have workers having the democratic right, the freedom of association, freedom of speech. And that's what being a union is a part of. We believe very strongly that budgets are moral documents. Don't say you care about families and then pass budgets that destroy families.
Last week, the Ohio Senate passed Bill SB 5, which attacks the right of workers to collectively bargain. Unlike a similar bill proposed in the state of Wisconsin, the Ohio legislation additionally removes the right of firefighters and law enforcement to collectively bargain. The state's assembly is expected to take up the bill this week. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan took to the floor of the House of Representatives last week and said the legislation proposed in his home state is unfair and undermines American values.
Firefighters who go in the burning buildings when we're all running out of them, police officers who we call up when we're in trouble, or teachers that we ask in many instances to spend more time with our kids than we do, somehow push the blame of the major financial meltdown that happened because of Wall Street recklessness? Blame the teachers for that?
Ryan added that budgeting priorities in Ohio seem to be out of line.
We have the top person who works for the current administration get a $40,000 pay increase from what the last governor was paying, and the secretaries and the people in the mailroom get a cut. And the firefighters and the police and the teachers get a cut. While all this is going on in Ohio, they want to cut the estate tax for the wealthiest people who live in the state of Ohio and ask the teacher to make the sacrifice.
This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. By giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally, so feel free to drop us a line. You know, we're seeing across the country a bunch of the governors are saying, you know what, we need cuts, massive cuts. And in Colorado, it's no different. You've got a Democrat, John Hickenlooper. There's a heck of a name. Say that 10 times fast. He's proposing a massive $375 million cut to education. And, you know, like our governor here, he's proposing to close 4 state parks. Yet, they've got citizens who, you know, I don't know how often Tom Cruise lives in the state of Colorado, but he's got a net worth of about $250 million. So he's worth about $250 million. And on his $18 million estate, 248 acres of property he owns there in Colorado, he pays just $400 a year. $400 a year. Now, you know, I guess, you know, maybe I just don't understand. Help me if you do. But here's the thing. Here's a guy worth $250 million, owns 248 acres. I don't believe he's farming it or ranching it or doing anything else. He pays just $400 a year. And how does he do it? Well, he's manipulating a tax break that was designed for struggling farmers. According to the Denver Post, actors, captains of industry and Ivy League, astrologers, sports figures, politicians, all these are also considered farmers or ranchers for tax purposes in Colorado. They have secured low property taxes through agricultural designations on the land they own, even though they personally have little or nothing to do with producing food. The reason the state legislators originally created a low property tax rate for the agricultural sector was so that you could have people who produce. Actor Tom Cruise, he owns 5 parcels of land on a scenic area northwest of Telluride that has become an enclave for high-end vacation homes. Sheep graze around the mansions for brief periods each year, according to the assessor's office. And you look at this and you go, I don't know, should we not be asking for, Mr. Cruz, just contribute a little bit? Now, our governor there, Hickenlooper, he benefits from the same bizarre loophole. His 225-acre property, he pays just $75 a year in property tax. But we're going to cut education. And I guess, according to Cruz, Tom Cruise thinks that maybe the Flying Spaghetti Monster told him it was okay, or whatever it is that cult of a religion that he belongs to. I probably shouldn't have said that. They're going to sue me now, because that's all they ever do.
Because you call them a cult.
Yeah, great. Quick, call the lawyers.
Well, we could be getting sued. Let's put this in perspective. I don't know about your home, but my home is a typical, I would say, working class, blue collar neighborhood. I pay quite a bit more than $75, I guarantee you. And I'm sure you do too.
And I don't have a problem with that.
But
that's the thing, man. These rich folks, they don't. They get away, they figure out how to abuse these tax loopholes, they figure out how to skate out from under it, and they walk away from it. And it's you and me who are stuck holding the bag. And yet, we could point these things out day and night, and there are T-twits in this country who would go, well, you know, that's just how it's supposed to be. That's America. Gotta love it. I'm just not getting it. Just not getting it. Also, other good news on the Koch brother front. There's a video going around of Scott Brown, the senator from Massachusetts, bending over and kissing the behind of billionaire David Koch for supporting his election in 2010, and then pretty much begging for more money. Can I have more money, please? I'm going to have an election next year. I'm going to need more money. David Koch directly gave the National Republican Senatorial Committee over $30,000 in November of 2009, and Koch Industries threw in $15,000 to the NRSC plus $5,000 more directly to Brown for Brown's special election. So, right there, you're looking at over $50,000 from the Koch brothers to Brown. Now, $50,000 to you and me is a lot of money. To someone like David Koch, drop in the bucket. And what frustrates me is how cheaply our senators are for sale. To be honest, $50,000 is not a lot of money. But it gets you a senator who on this video, and you got to see the video, is basically bending over backwards to kiss this guy's behind to say, oh, please send me more money. I need your cash. I'm going to be fighting for my life. Please, more money. Which for me, I'm a firm believer, we got to get people like Koch out of it. We got to get the big dollar people out of it. And it comes down to campaign finance reform. It comes down to, for me anyway, federally funded elections. Speaking of another crazy governor, that Rick Scott down in Florida, remember he unveiled his first budget proposal, because we need to make sweeping changes to state government. And how do we do that? Well, we're going to slash billions in taxes and spending. So all of the spending cuts we made in Florida, according to him, will be given away in tax handouts for the very, very wealthy. Now, his plan is to cut $1 billion in property taxes over 2 years and nearly $1.5 billion in corporate income taxes over that 2 years. Going to cut the corporate income tax rate from 5.5% down to 3%, and then he wants to do away with it, all at a time when you're talking about slashing education. And our friends over at Think Progress asked the question, is $2,300 a year worth for a pay cut for the average teacher worth $44 in property taxes for saving the average Florida home? Because evidently in this whole big property tax budget, you're going to get about $45, and that's what the teachers are going to get cut. They're talking about cutting nearly $2 billion from education so that they can hand out all this money. And I go back, you know, to what our governor did here. You know, on Tuesday, no more adult basic. Adult basic goes by the wayside. 42,000 workers, you know, low-income workers out into the street. Now, we can make an argument, and you know, I'll argue with you about it, that the employers should have provided health care to those folks. And if we had a government worth its salt, if we had leaders with any vision or any stones, they would force those employers to provide some health care. Or find a way for it to happen so working people have health care. We got to figure out how to do that. And if they can't, then it's the job of the government to step in and do it. What we saw Tuesday, no more health care for you folks. On Friday, a massive, anywhere from $200 to $833 million tax cut for corporations to invest in machinery. Now, that's a little complicated. And I think that's the reason we saw no media coverage of it, because it is a complicated issue. And the complicated part of it is corporations who are going to invest in machinery and equipment, they're going to be able to take their full tax break this year, retroactive to the last quarter of 2010 through this year, right up front. So you're not going to see those taxes down the road. It's going to cost us a boatload of money. And they're talking about phasing those out over the couple of years, so we may never see any tax gains. But it's on this bizarre belief that those people are going to use that money to turn around and create jobs. And it hasn't happened in the past. It didn't happen when Obama did it. It didn't happen when Bush did it. So it's not going to happen now. And what I find interesting is, you know, we had a Republican governor the last time this happened. Bush tried, pushed it through, and the Republican governor said, no, we're not going to do it. And you got to give Schweiker credit for that, Jake. And I do. So it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting on the priority level to see where this stuff goes. Anyway, last week, the National People's Action and Public Accountability Initiative, there are these folks who are Make Wall Street Pay protests. They put out a big report, Big Banks Tax Drain. They took over a Bank of America branch in Washington, D.C. over its tax dodging. And you got to give them credit. You know, these folks marched right in. They shut it down. It was pretty amazing. Six banks so far: Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley together paid tax at an approximate rate of 11% of their pre-tax earnings in 2009 and 10. Had they paid 35%, you know, where they're supposed to, the legally mandated part of it, that would have been enough to cover 2 years of salaries for the 132,000 teachers who lost their jobs since this economic crisis began. Again, you know, it goes back to this: we need to make Wall Street pay, and in a big way. And that's their website, makewallstreetpay.org. We'll get a link up on our site at thericksmithshow.com. But I find it interesting. You know, on Monday morning they hit the presses. Hundreds of fed-up homeowners, you know, with protests across the country, brought businesses to a screeching halt, and even the Speaker of the House's office, because, you know, and I wish there was one locally. I wish we could have found one of these locally, but again, and they do it in larger cities like New York and Washington, but I find it interesting, and I'm hoping that the attorney generals, who have launched an investigation, We'll push this forward. We'll see some of these bankers held accountable, even though we have not so far at this point.
Well, there is light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, now some key people in this whole scenario are saying, look, if that happens to you and they want to foreclose, whatever you do, don't leave your house. Stay there. Make them prove that they have the legitimate right to kick you out of the house. And the truth is, some of the banks really didn't dot their I's and cross their T's. So if you have problems out there and they want to foreclose, under no circumstances, leave your home.
Produce the note. That's the battle cry. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Talk Radio News Service, our good friend Victoria Jones will be here. We're right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's autocratic attempt to abrogate the democratic right of public employees to bargain with their governmental bosses is not wearing well with the public. Recent polls show that a mere one-third of Wisconsinites favor his blatantly political power play, and that if he had told voters in last year's election that he intended to do this, he would have lost. After only 1 month in office, Walker's approval rating has plummeted, and he's become a national poster boy for right-wing anti-union extremism. Indeed, he's so out of step that he's even being jeered by democracy fighters in Egypt. Yet, Walker is but one of a flock of far-right corporate-crested Republican governors and Congress critters who are waging an all-out class war on unionized workers. It's a shameful effort to bust the wage structure and legal protections that support America's already endangered middle class. In Washington, for example, loopy GOP leaders are out to abolish the legal mechanism to which workers can form a union and have their bargaining rights protected. Meanwhile, war-whooping Republican governors in Ohio, New Jersey, Indiana, and elsewhere are slashing the health care and pension benefits owed to public employees, blaming these middle-class workers for their state's fiscal misses. But state budgets have been depleted by the economic crash caused by Wall Street greed and massive tax giveaways to wealthy elites, not by a firefighter's pension or a teacher's health plan. This is Jim Hightower saying, and check out Nevada, where the Chamber of Commerce is even pushing to eliminate the minimum wage. This corporate-funded Republican assault is not about fiscal responsibility. The corporate powers intend nothing less than to dismantle the entire framework of America's economic democracy and return us to the dark days of robber baron plutocracy. To the barricades, people!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. And now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to.
What is going on in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, one thing very interesting, President Obama reversed a 2-year-old order halting new military charges against detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba today, and he's permitted a resumption of military trials under rules that he says provide adequate rights for defendants. But he's also really implicitly admitted the failure, for now anyway, of his pledge to close the prison camp. But he does say that he's committed to closing Guantanamo Bay someday and also to charging some terrorist suspects in civilian criminal courts.
Well, he should. I mean, that is what he ran his entire campaign on.
Indeed, because Congress has blocked the transfer of prisoners from Guantanamo to the U.S. for trial, so he can't do that for now.
Yeah, I found it interesting that you saw some conservatives coming out and saying we need to have trials, like Mike Lee.
Yeah.
It's amazing how that whole thing has changed.
You know, there's been a real sort of seismic shift in this area, which has really been quite fascinating. He also today signed an executive order setting out new rules, and they require a review of all detainees' status within a year, and then every 3 years after that to determine whether they remain a threat to Americans. And the order also requires compliance with the Geneva Conventions and the international treaty that bans torture and inhumane treatment. Now, not everybody's happy about this. Human Rights First is saying, look, basically, the president says this is a step down the road towards institutionalizing a preventive detention regime. People in the Mideast are looking to establish new rules for their own societies, and this sends a mixed message at best.
Absolutely. And I got to be honest, you know, I look at this, and the reality is Bush is out of the equation here. This is Obama's baby.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know, we're more than 2 years into his term now, and almost everything is at this point.
It's one of those things I wish you would have taken care of earlier. And we'd be done with this.
But you know, he really thought, I think, that he could get this closed down, and he got into office and started to see, when he looked at it, that there was no way he was going to be able to do it once he actually looked at the complexity of it.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that I said from the beginning. You don't know what, when you get into that room, when they lay it out for you, it's a lot easier to say than to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the case with so many things once you step into that job.
I don't think I'd want it, but
exactly. It's why most of us don't want the gig.
Which is why we end up with some of the schmucks that we see. I mean, you look at the Republican side of the coin. There is not a decent candidate among them. I wouldn't pay one of them to sweep my driveway.
And there they are in Iowa tonight, as a matter of fact, really with the first event of the Republican campaign. At the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition event.
Amazing. Yeah, and I'm amazed. You know, Newt Gingrich stands there with clear-faced. I guess consequences of sin don't apply to him.
Well, they apply to Senator John Ensign, because today he did say that there are consequences to sin when he announced his retirement, and he will not seek a third term. And he said there are consequences to sin, and when you're in a leadership role, those consequences can affect a lot of other people. Now, of course, yes, he's putting his family first, but there's another reality here, which is that he's looked at the polls and he's looked at what's going on, and the reality is that he probably wasn't going to win. Representative Dean Heller, Republican, private and public polling was showing, was trouncing Ensign in primary matchups.
Oh, but the other thing sounds so much better.
Well, this is politics after all. And another thing we're likely to see in the Nevada primary is the reemergence of the favorite of everybody in the media, of course, Sharron Angle.
Oh, please say it's so.
It's so.
And next you're going to tell me Christine O'Donnell's going to come back.
She might. She didn't do Dancing with the Stars. That doesn't mean she won't do something else.
That's because she's going to work on her book, didn't you know?
Got to work on that book. We're dying to. Was it a book of spells or what?
It might be, or it might be in crayon. I don't know.
Yeah.
What else is going on?
Well, tomorrow, of course, the Senate's back today. The House is back tomorrow. Tomorrow in the Senate, we're expecting a couple of very important votes. In a way, they're important. In a way, they're not. What they are, they're going to be dueling votes on the two sides opening bargaining positions for fiscal 2011 on the spending bill to cut $61.5 billion, Republican side, and the Democratic alternative $6.5 billion for the budget. So they're going to see how many votes they can get on both of these, and if they can get 60 votes. Obviously, we're talking about, is it going to be enough? Can they get enough votes? In other words, if they could get enough, then maybe they could avert a government shutdown on March the 18th. Nobody expects that they're going to be able to get 60 votes on either of those proposals. So if they don't get 60 votes, then Harry Reid is going to turn around and say, look, we weren't able to get 60 votes, then you've got to go and make a deal.
Well, they're going to have to, or we play this game of political chicken, and we'll see where that takes us.
And I think that's what they really expect to see, actually, is a game of political chicken being played.
And I think the Republicans, they're still sore from the loss during the Clinton years, and they want to try it again.
And I think we may see it. I mean, we may well see another continuing resolution March the 18th, maybe even a four-week one this time, because I think it's going to be tough to get a decision made by March the 18th. But it's possible that we're going to get a shutdown. It's a possibility.
And what else is going on?
Well, the other thing that I would mention is coming out of Wisconsin, and I know that you were there, and that is, of course, we've had a really weird day there with this offer from the Democrats to meet Governor Walker at the Wisconsin-Illinois border and a response from Governor Walker dismissing what he called a misleading request from the top Democrat in the state Senate, saying we need reasonable and responsible officials, saying the letter was absolutely ridiculous, and basically trashing various Democrats involved, with the upshot being that all the Democrats have banded together. Any Democrats who he thought he might have done a deal with have now really become closer to the other Democrats, and any result that he might have hoped to have had, he's not had. So things are not looking good for a deal in Wisconsin.
And good. I hope Walker stays his ground, and I hope his crazy goes as far as crazy takes him.
So far, that looks to be exactly what you're going to see.
Yeah, if he had half a brain, or if the Republican Governors Association would send somebody to tell him to back off a little bit, I think he could win this thing. But fortunately for us, he's gonna stay the course.
Yeah, he does not seem to want to move at all.
Well, you know, like the one sign I saw in the Capitol when we were there. Maybe it does take a college degree. And lastly, what do we got going on there in Washington?
The final item I would mention is a Pentagon study that came out today saying that women should serve in combat. This is a new 20-point report. The Military Leadership Diversity Commission has called for the extermination of the combat exclusion policy. The main reason they say that women should serve in ground combat units is because they say it will help their uniform careers. That is bound to be attacked by many people who will say, well, this is just, you know, they're just doing this for equal opportunity. But no, what this commission says is, given the nature of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, women are currently engaged in direct combat, even when it's not part of their formally assigned role. So basically, they had a near unanimous agreement on this, and they're saying it's just obsolete for them not to be serving in combat.
Well, that's a decision above my pay grade. I'm not sure how I feel about that, to be honest.
I think many people have mixed views on this.
I don't know that I wouldn't want my daughters on the front lines, but here's the thing. I would want them to have the opportunity.
I think that's the difference, isn't it? We want people to have the opportunity to make those decisions for themselves.
Yeah, that's pretty much where my position has been on that. But then again, you fear all of the evil things that could come about it. I think of that Jessica Lynch girl.
I know, but it's coming about now because they're already on the front lines.
Good, excellent point. And again, you look at Jessica Lynch. There she was. Right there in the heat of things.
Yeah.
Victoria, I appreciate your time. Thanks for the update from Washington, D.C. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix any thing? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Work it hard to make a left. Rich and far red. Far the shore, black caviar. Blue denim, hell is vain.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Now for breaking news, up to the minute last, this is the story of the night. We cannot live without the next story. This is a Rick Smith Show, well, it's not exclusive, but we're going to claim it is anyway. Go ahead. Do your exclusive.
Okay.
Exclusive.
Thank you for the intro, Rick. But seriously, I mean, to me, this is a big story. The Air Force has officially, finally, after about a three-year battle, awarded Boeing the contract for the U.S. Air Force's next generation of aerial refueling tankers. Now, they were in competition with the European consortium Airbus. Thank you, thank you. I believe... thank you. Originally, I believe Airbus was given the contract. Boeing protested, approached the Pentagon. The Pentagon looked at it and decided that originally the numbers were kind of skewed, and they started looking at all the subsidies that the Airbus had been given by. It amounted to hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. So it wasn't a fair competition, and in the end, they awarded it to Boeing. Now, what does that mean? That means 50,000 jobs. Throughout the United States. Thank you. In about 35 states. Now, these are unionized jobs. These are good-paying jobs. If Airbus would have gotten it, that would have been not so good. It would have amounted to about 500 lower-level paying jobs, low-paying jobs in Alabama. I like that dirge, by the way. And the problem I have, we discussed this in a serious nature. We did discuss this. It would have been given to Europeans, some of the European countries that may or may not long-term be our friend. We would have been giving him some top-secret technology that could have been used against us. So great to see 50,000 jobs in the United States. Thank you, Pentagon.
Yeah, baby. Oh, yeah, baby.
Another development. And this is ongoing in Wisconsin. The Democrats have reached out to the governor, the recalcitrant governor, and the Republican leader. Republican leader Scott Ferguson. They have offered to meet at the border of Illinois and Wisconsin with the governor and the Republican leader, Fitzgerald. As of tonight, there has been no reply. The governor has pretty much ignored it. The Democrats continue to reach out. You know, stay tuned on that one. This is a long, long saga. And you got, God bless the Democrats are holding out, and hopefully they can hold out a lot longer. Interesting development when you talk about Wisconsin, Rick. We have talked in this show several times about what they do in Europe when they have a general strike. I know the farmers were upset a couple times. I believe it was Paris, France, where the farmers, thousands of them, came in with their implements and shut down the city of Paris, and it was very effective. Well, something similar is happening. A couple farmers associations have decided to come on Saturday to come and join the protest with their tractors. They have decided to come in Madison. They have decided, and rightfully so, that they should be part of this process in the rural communities for a very simple reason. Thank you. Rural communities will be disproportionately hurt by Walker's proposed budget. Farmers in Wisconsin want to send a message that they can stand with state workers and all working and middle-class families in the state. Actually, it's great to see what the labor movement has been effective. And one of the reasons they've been effective, they've been able to draw and pull in some real allies within the community and the business community. That was great to see.
I got a special message from Governor Scott Walker. This is a Rick Smith Show exclusive from the governor.
Okay.
Nothing. I see nothing, and I see nothing.
That's true.
What did we borrow Sergeant Schultz for that one? It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Go ahead. What else you got?
Well,
what other breaking stories do we have?
I'm going to run with it.
Might as well.
We talked about Michael Moore's speech. And I agree with him. There's a lot of money in this country. Problem is, it's disproportionately going to the rich. A local gentleman by the name of Paul Heist, who's a professor emeritus, he taught at Lebanon Valley College. He taught political science. He's also an economist. Has come out with a paper, and I think he's right on. And he talks about a little bit of this. And this is a few high points of what he said. At the end of 2008, did we have a serious crisis on our financial sector? Yes, we did, but those problems were related to the financial bubble, and the financial sector got bailed out. The burden of taxation, you always hear about that. Taxes, taxes, tax. Well, according to Mr. Heiss, that's not the problem. Federal government's tax receipts amount to about 14.5% of the GDP. This is the lowest, I repeat, this is the lowest in 50 years. Tax receipts for 2009 for all federal, state, and local governments are only about 17% of GDP. That's down from the normal 20 to 22%. Why? Because of the tax cuts for the rich. The burden of taxes in the United States of America is now lower than it has been in 50 years. Federal deficit. We hear a lot about the deficit. According to Mr. Heiss, the federal deficit and the national debt are similarly not a serious problem. We fed a lot of large numbers which are essentially meaningless in order to panic us into accepting someone else's political agenda. Mainly, you guessed it, cutting Social Security, cutting Medicaid, and cutting Medicare. Privatizing Social Security merely hands overpaid New York bankers part of your retirement. Now, here's the bottom line. There isn't a problem. Why is everyone complaining and feeling so hard up? Now, those are his words. Actually, two real problems exist and converge: the lack of income and the increased cost of health care. The working class has had a pay raise since 1978, and does not have the money to maintain its standard of living. Our economy in 2010 is producing more than twice as much as it was in 1980, but all that increase went to the richest 10% of the people. The rich took all the money, and now they want to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and they label it as unaffordable. I think all those are cogent points. It just reinforces what Michael Moore has said. Thank you, Professor Heiss. Rick?
Oh, you done reading?
Yes, I am.
All
thank
right.
You.
Well, it was one correction. That's actually 60 years. the lowest rate of taxation in 60 years.
Okay.
Was the official number that's been bouncing around for the last couple of days.
Well,
look when you have wealth that's been distributed the way it's been, and it is one of these scenarios where you go, at some point, we have to wake up and face the reality that we're not spending much more than we did. Had we not had the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, had we not had the massive Bush handouts early in the term, we would be fine. I mean, I think everybody seems to forget that we've handed out trillions of dollars, $1.7 trillion we handed to the very wealthy in this country. And why? In the hopes that maybe, possibly, maybe they'd create jobs, like Bush says here.
A package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief. We will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Well, you know what? How do I get one of those jobs to pay $550,000 a piece? How do I get one of those? They handed out all this money. Why? In the hopes that quite possibly, we hope the very wealthy create a job. Well, it didn't happen. Again, had you taken that money and invested it in education, invested it in infrastructure, invested it in any number of things, health care, things that create jobs, things that put people to work, had we done that, we'd be much better off. Because those people who have jobs pay taxes. And those people who pay taxes, increase the revenue to the state, to the country, whatever. Thus, no deficit. You know, again, we've been schnookered here. We've been taken for a ride. This is the game of three-card money, and we all lost. But they keep thinking that, hey, you got a prize. Here's a little trinket. Go ahead. You got your consolation prize. But at the end of it, man, we're standing here broke. We're standing here with credit cards instead of paychecks. We're standing here hoping that the Republicans will do what they say they're going to do. And all they keep saying is, well, you know, like Bush's old man.
Read my lips.
I don't mind new taxes on people who have a whole bunch of money, Jake. I mean, at the end of this, folks.
Well.
At the end of this, the people who have all the wealth in this country have all the wealth for a reason.
Have we said, as we have said on this show quite a few times in the last 3-4 years, you know, the Republicans like to talk about the federal deficit and the national debt. What they should be concentrating on are two things. The trade deficit, which means jobs, and the redistribution of wealth, which means if you redistribute it equitably, what does that mean? You're gonna put it in the middle class. The middle class is gonna expand, and by giving the money to them, they're gonna spend it, and we are gonna enhance the viability of a middle class, which is the heart and soul of a strong long-term economy. And we don't. When was the last time you heard alarms about the trade deficit? And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, at literally every month. And our trade deficit with China is just through the roof. But when was the last politician, especially from the Republican side, sounding the alarm?
Well, what do we get? We get John McCain. We get John McCain who says, you know.
Well, I think it's obviously a recognition of the reality and the trends that cheaper, lower cost labor products will usually prevail over products made in a higher wage and income countries. But
at the end of it. What he just said there is true. He's right. But everything he said after that contradicts that. He's saying we need more free trade agreements, even though he admits low-wage countries prevail over high-wage countries. He says we can compete with anyone, yet low-wage countries prevail over high-wage countries. So is it that he wants to take us down the road towards a low-wage country? I would say evidently, because he obviously seems to understand. He has stated, not in the most eloquent of terms, but he has, garbled through and mumbled through a very true reality. The low-wage countries are kicking our behinds. Why? Because we're letting them. And I go back to that ABC show where they went into these people's homes. And they took everything out that wasn't made in the U.S. And all that was left was some cheap vase. And that was it, man. They went through, you know, the furniture, they went through the bedding, they went through everything, all the consumer goods. And they're saying, you know, so it's a 60% of all the things in the U.S. are made overseas. I would say in the consumer goods market, it's got to be higher than I think you'd have a hard time finding 10% of the stuff in a Walmart made in the U.S. And the stuff that is all mechanized. You know, like those cheap, crummy bowls you get, the plastic bowls, the Sterilite plastic bowls. Those are all made by machines. There are no people who actually work there. It's all stamped out. The only people who work there are people who put the things on the trucks. So, of course, it's made here. It's the cheap, you know, stuff that's mechanized that remains. So, you know, if they know this stuff, why do we continue down the same path?
Well, but
why
if, you, are we doing if this? You listen to the right-wing talking heads, Rick, they'll tell you, oh, you know, this free trade has brought in cheap goods to Walmart, and that helps the middle class. It saves them money.
Yeah, well, if you don't have a job and you don't have any money,
exactly right.
How's it going to save you anything?
It doesn't.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap this up. Thanks for being here.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
In 1927, 800 miners in the captive company town of Rossiter, located in Pennsylvania's Indiana County, joined a nationwide bituminous coal miner strike. From the start, Judge Jonathan Langham began issuing the most drastic injunctions imaginable against the workers and their union, the United Mine Workers of America. These injunctions prohibited miners from taking part in any picketing, marching, assembly for meetings and rallies, posting of signs, or giving any type of aid or comfort to the striking miners or their families. The miners were even prohibited from putting ads in the newspaper. The most outrageous of Langham injunctions received national attention. Judge Jonathan Langham ruled that workers were prohibited from holding prayer services and singing of hymns, described as hostile songs, at the Magyar Presbyterian Church, which was the only property in town not owned by the Clearfield Bituminous Coal Corporation. Striking miners were evicted from their company-owned homes and forced to live in tent colonies. Conditions were so poor that nearly one out of every 10 babies died at birth. Reports of these deplorable conditions were the basis of a U.S. Senate investigation into the conditions of the coal fields and company towns in Pennsylvania. The investigations were led by New York Senator Robert Wagner, who later sponsored the bill creating the National Labor Relations Act, otherwise known as the Wagner Act of 1935. Senator Wagner said of the conditions he found, quote, "Had I not seen it myself, I would not have believed that in the United States there were large areas where civil government was supplanted by a system that can only be compared with ancient feudalism. The sacrifices by these workers and fights for democracy by the Rossiter citizens helped change the social and political attitudes for the century to follow. It was these deadly fights and grave sacrifices by those who came before that allow us to live so well today." The tombstone of one of such worker reads, "40 years I worked with pick and drill down in the mines against my will. The coal king's slave, but now it's past. Thanks be to God, I am free at last." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, on fake news on Fox, Alan Simpson, the former Wyoming Republican senator, who's famous for some, you know, some interesting comments and basically for just being a jerk. I can't make much stronger comments than that. You may remember last summer when he compared, you know, those folks on Social Security as someone who was milking off the teats of a cow. He's saying Social Security was a milk cow with 300 teats, and those greedy geezers who couldn't get off the government teat were sucking it dry. Well, evidently, he's back. And, you know, every time I see him, he gets nastier and nastier. He's just this old curmudgeon who, you know, somebody needs to... Somebody just say, Alan, buddy, go sit somewhere. Go take a walk. Maybe a long walk. But this is what he... Kind of interesting and kind of weird all at once. It's one of those things that makes you go...
Doing nothing. If they care at all about their children or grandchildren, sometimes I doubt that. I think, you know...
I guess not.
he reflects an attitude, and I've heard it said. And you kind of, I wouldn't say you reflect it, but a couple times you talked about, you know, what I call the greatest, I do believe it's the greatest generation.
Yeah, you've said.
No, I do believe it.
You've said.
But why would you call them greedy? Because their generation fought for this, and it's something that came out of their paychecks. It's something that was well-earned. It's something that helps them not having to go back into poverty. How is that being greedy? Somebody's going to have to explain that. How is that being greedy? They earned it. The old-fashioned way. They went out and worked for it. Not the old-fashioned way that the rich earn it. Inherit it. Inherit their wealth. They went out and they earned it. Every day on the job. How is that being greedy? Because they were successful? I mean, someone's going to have to explain that logic to me. Why people who have Medicare and Social Security somehow are stealing from our children? How so?
Yeah, they're greedy old people, like you, greedy.
Well, you know what? I worked 42 years, and I'm typical of millions and millions and millions of Americans. I worked all my life. I got up. I went to work every day, and every paycheck, there was a certain amount that came off my paycheck, and there was a certain amount that was matched by my employer. It was self-funded, in theory at least. It was self-funded. And you know what? You know what, old man? You didn't give me a cent of your tax money, so sit down and shut up.
Yeah, well, you're just greedy. See, that's it. So anyway, let's try this again. This is what Alan Simpson had to say, which is, I guess...
Doing nothing. If they care at all about their children or grandchildren, sometimes I doubt that. I think, you know, grandchildren now don't write a thank you for the Christmas presents. They're walking on their pants or their cap on backwards, listening to the Animal Man, the Snoopy Snoopy Poop Dog, and they don't like them. But I'll tell you one thing.
This is where Erskine starts twitching.
No, Erskine has often grabbed me as I get it's near ranting, and not quite my wife.
No, it's just senility.
I was going to say, has he been checked lately? Has
I don't know. The enema man.
Did he miss his meds that day? Is that it? Can we explain that away? All I can say is, if that's the truth, then he's been missing his meds for a while.
I thought it was funny he called him the enema man for Eminem. And the Snoopy Poopy Dog.
Snoopy Poopy Dog.
Which you go, really? Have you looked at your Depends lately? Anyway. Enough with that. Limbaugh, evidently his parent company, is still using these. We talked about this the other day, the fake radio call-in people, which, you know, again, you know, you listen to those programs, and it's so well scripted, and it's so beautiful. It's a piece of political mastery. But, again, you know, we talked about Tabloid Magazine saying that Premier Radio Network, a subsidiary of Clear Channel, hires these actors to call in as guests. And they're not guests named as guests. They're call-in people. So all day long they sit and they call in to talk radio programs. And they make about $40 an hour for doing this, which is a pretty good gig if you can get it. And evidently Premier On Call is the service that, you know, this group does. And they call into these places. And it always amazed me that you had these very articulate, on message voices. I mean, they were always right on message, and they always reiterated what the host had to say. And, you know, look, we don't do that here. I don't have that kind of money, nor would I. It's disingenuous. But again, you've got to understand what they're doing. It's all about that political theater and pushing out that, and they really want to have a discussion. You rarely hear anybody disagree with them, but it's about pushing that I'm always right. It's for that person who's just absorbing and listening. It's pretty remarkable.
I wonder if they have any progressive talk shows. Maybe I'll submit my. I could earn some. I could use some part time money.
$40 an hour?
Hey, for yapping.
And I wonder if you got to talk that entire hour. I wonder if it's just listening. Because you can't have the same guy calling the same show.
If you call in, you have to wait. You have to wait online. I mean, you know, this is, a lot of these are national.
And they, well, I'm sure they would save you for the most opportune time. Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal broke the inside scoop in Washington today, writing that playing a game of political chicken, Democratic senators who fled to Wisconsin to stymie restrictions on public employee unions said Sunday that they plan to come back from exile soon, betting that even though their return will allow the bill to pass, the curbs are so unpopular, they'll taint the state's Republican governor and legislatures. Here's the problem. The Democrats say, we never said that. And two, the Wall Street Journal is now reporting so-called news without any factual quotes. No factual information whatsoever. Interesting stuff. And if any of this in this piece, if anything, you know, you look at this, this piece is designed to try and split the Democrats. To cause dissension in the ranks, if you will. But not a single direct quote. That's interesting to me. And the other part of this is they say, well, you know, they left to fight, to stymie the restrictions on public employee unions, on those unions. Have you seen the rest of the bill? Have you seen the major cuts, the draconian, painful, massive destruction that's in this bill? I mean, this is a couple hundred page document of nothing but destruction for the middle class.
While at the same time,
and handouts for corporations.
Yep, fireside sale.
And we're going to have that here tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Dave Filman from AFSCME about what he sees of the conversation tomorrow morning. Also, we're going to talk with Mike Sterling, state representative, a couple other folks, you know, to kind of get a gist of maybe digest a little bit what the budget's, what Corbett's coming out with, what it's going to mean, how we might start thinking of reacting to this, because I look at tomorrow as the start. You know, we've kind of been asleep for a while. There hasn't been an awful lot on the state level because we've been focused on Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana. We've been looking elsewhere. And that's, you know, really, honestly, what we've done is we've given Corbett a pretty good lead. He has been able to, you know, pretty much do whatever he wants without taking any of the political hits. Tomorrow is going to be the day where he steps into the spotlight and says, here, this document, this is my priority. This is my morality. These are my values. This is my vision. And I'm telling you, what's going to come of it is deep, painful cuts for you and me. And we're going to foot the bill. And corporations are going to walk away. Now, you know, the hopes, you know, I have some Republican friends who seem to buy into this theory that if we give the corporations everything, it will somehow trickle down like, you know, rivers of gold, honey, flowing all over our yeah, got sidetracked there for a minute. This trickle down theory that somehow we're going to be okay, and that has not been the case. It really has not been proven to be the case, even though we keep trying the same failed stuff over and over and over and over and over again. It looks like we're going to have to do it again, but this time I think is different. I think people are watching, and I hope people look at what happens tomorrow with a skeptical eye and say, how's this going to affect me and how's it going to affect my community? How's it going to affect my family's pocketbook? And I think it's going to be drastic. There's just no other way of putting that. So tomorrow ought to be an interesting day. Again, if you want to check out the website, thericksmithshow.com, missed any portion of the program here tonight, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcast. It's there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. We'd love to hear your commentary, your thoughts, questions, comments. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. We will see you tomorrow, and it's going to be a doozy.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the
The
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO.